You filed a flight plan to mountain rescue. If we don't report in, they'll come looking for us.
Now, that's how it's supposed to work, except I put in a flight plan for Borum Caverns, and this isn't Borum Caverns, is it, Juno?
We're in the wrong cave.
Where are we?
It hasn't got a name. It's a new system. No one's ever been down here before.
Let me ask you a question. Would you prefer to stay alive without your mommy and daddy or die with them? That's a tough question, huh?
It was moving. It was alive. It knows we're here. We just have to go. We have
we
to
can't
go.
Do
we
that.
You didn't see it. I'm not staying here.
If we try to leave, they kill us.
We're being quarantined here. We are being kept here to die.
While you were looking for me, I was looking for you. Well, I got you now.
Was that him in the car?
Yeah, sure it was. Because it walked very far.
Why is that?
Because I cut off his legs.
And I'm gonna do the same to you.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you?
I am fantastic, so I guess we'll be discussing me.
Okay. And in the state of New York?
This is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
I'm fine. Waiting for Halloween.
Yep, that's right. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone, this is Dave.
Dave, how are you?
I'm well.
And in the state of Connecticut?
Hello, this is Christy Peterson-Schoonover.
Hi, Christy, how are you?
I'm awesome. A little run down, but awesome.
Fair enough. And today is October 29th is the recording of this episode. Our podcast discusses genre films and things of that nature. And before we get into any of those things, Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan?
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it on Stitcher or the iTunes Store.
And Mike, you do a genre blog.
Yeah, it's called Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com.
Abe, you do a genre blog?
Yep, it's called A Real Movie Reviewer. Real spelled R-E-E-L-E-R, Movie Reviewer. You can find it by going to your basic search engine and typing right in, or you can visit the Dark Discussions main page and look on your right-hand side. You'll be a link to my blog there, along with other goodies such as the sites mentioned by both Eric and Mike, and a few other buddies as well.
That's right, and that includes Chrissy. You have some stuff?
Yep, I write short dark fiction, and you can find out about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com, and if you butcher it, don't worry, there's only one of me.
And as Abe said, there's a link on the right side, her book, Bad Apple. There's a little graphic there. You can press that. It brings you right to her blog. So today, again, is the 29th of October. So it's 2 days before Halloween. And big time for many folks, especially folks who listen to this podcast. There's a couple of films that came out recently, Crimson Peak, Paranormal Activity 6 or 5 or whatever it's called now, and
Ghost Dimension.
Yeah, there you go. So those were the two big ones that came out at theaters, that are horror. Green Inferno was a couple of weeks earlier. A few horror films on VOD came out in October, including The Diabolical, starring Ali Larter, Circle, which is now actually on Netflix, and The Final Girls, a horror comedy, and I'm sure there's a few others that I just can't get my finger on right now. But before we get into our topic tonight, why don't we go around and see if anybody wants to mention any news or genre movies that they've seen that would interest people who listen. Eric, why don't you start?
Okay. I'll actually start with news, since I don't usually do that, just for a change of pace. It appears that Ash vs. Evil Dead has already been picked up for a second season, so that's pretty awesome. Before the pilot has even hit the air, they're already on for a second season, so I was happy to hear that. Groovy. Yes. Mm-hmm. As far as what I've been watching, I watched a movie called The Vatican Tapes last weekend. I'd heard about it a while back and had been curious, and now it's available on iTunes. It's not the worst thing I've ever seen, but it's not great either. It starts off pretty slow, and then it gets good towards the end, but just as it's really like getting interesting, it ends. So I was a little disappointed in that. So you can wait for free Netflix viewing on that one. Don't spend your money on a rental for it. What else?
So someday I want to see the review. This is the worst thing I have ever seen. Actually, I do. Actually, now I think about my, I had a professor in college. He said that about, what was the name of that movie? With Dan Aykroyd. Nothing But Trouble, I think.
I am unfamiliar.
It was really why. Bad. Oh, God, it was bad.
I watched the pilot episode of Supergirl. Out of sheer curiosity, because I've been reading so much about it recently.
And potential spank material.
Shh. And it's not bad for what it is. I mean, I'm sure they accomplished what they were trying to do. It's just a little cheesy for my personal taste. So if you're into, humorous, slightly cheesy, superhero with the girl power thing going on, by all means, check it out. I'm happy it's on the air. I want to see it succeed, but it's not quite my cup of tea, so I don't think I'm going to watch anymore. And other than that, I am extremely happy to see that the 30-minute short Kung Fury is actually available on Netflix at this point. It is a animated short that includes everything that was wonderful and horrible about the 80s. Including fake VHS tracking. So I highly encourage you to check that out on Netflix. If you want a little preview before you dedicate yourself to it on our group on Facebook, I posted about it in the comments thread. I posted a link to the YouTube video of David Hasselhoff singing the theme song for the movie. And in the music video for that, you see a few clips from the movie. So if you want to see what you're getting into before you head to Netflix, you can check that out. And that's what I've been watching.
All right, very good. What about yourself, Mike?
I could be wrong, but I don't think I've actually watched anything new.
You did see the Walking Dead last episode, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, but I mean, those are things that are TV shows that I watch every week, and right now I'm getting really even backlogged on my TV shows because Pam watches them with me, and we have like very little overlap time at this season, at this point in the year. Dead is like the only thing we're caught up on.
If you haven't seen anything of significance, why don't you give you a quick review of the latest episode of The Walking Dead, since I guess it surprised a number of folks.
Well, by the time this airs, the next episode, this is put out, I guess, for downloading, there will be the next episode of The Walking Dead. So without getting too spoilery, someone died in the previous episode. I think another solid episode for this season. Actually, a lot of people died, but there was somebody who died unexpectedly or maybe didn't. And so now the debate is whether or not the person who died actually died. Because the way the storyline's playing out, they're also fiddling a bit with the timeline. So, whether the person – because the producer sent over a weird statement after saying that we haven't seen the last of the character who clearly seemed to be dead. So they may be coming back as – a different part of the timeline we may be seeing them, so that might be why it's not the last time we've seen the character. Or it may be that they were bullshitting us and the character didn't actually die. And we'll hopefully find that out before, in the next episode. But it certainly for the first day, it really hit a lot of the people on the internet and people who watched it and took it hard because it was a tough loss. But then like everyone went back and watched it and thought about it and said, wait a minute. Maybe not. And it just was really bizarre. And I'm trying not to get too specific because, again, I don't want to spoil who it was for the people who haven't watched it yet. I
hope they don't cheat us and make it something else, but we'll see.
Well, they did this bunch before. They did it with Carol in the third season, where they thought that where everybody thought Carol had died.
Yep.
And then after that, I guess they're probably, I don't know if they were even doing like The Talking Dead at that point, but at The Talking Dead, which follows every episode of The Walking Dead, for those who for some reason don't know, they always have an in memoriam segment, and it's often joked that when an actor appears on the show, that it means they're going to die in the episode. So the actor who plays the character didn't show up in the episode, and his character wasn't included in the in memoriam segment.
Interesting.
And that same thing had happened, I think, or something similar, when Carol had supposedly died, but sure enough, we found her still alive, like one or two episodes later.
So, actually, I don't mean to interrupt,
yes,
but Nathan and Sean have had several actors from The Walking Dead on their show. And the ones they have trouble getting are always the ones that are going to come back. The ones that they've actually gotten were the ones who actually already knew that they were going to die. Dead. Yeah. And I know this particular guy that you're talking about, and they've been having trouble getting him.
Yeah.
So I would not doubt that this guy's going to come back.
Yeah. And, you know, it's somebody who at this point is alive in the comics. And, you know, so that's. So yeah, there's a lot of questions where it's going to go, but anyway, that's really been about it. It's been a very solid season, I think, and it's all just still one storyline that they're stretching out a lot. But it's certainly not one where in the second season they took a storyline, stretched it out, and very little is happening per episode. A lot's happening every episode, but they're really milking this storyline for everything it's worth.
Indeed, indeed. And speaking of Sean and Nathan's show, you're referring to exactly what, Chrissy?
It's called The Ghost Man and Demon Hunter Show. You can find it at www.ghostanddemon.com. They've been on the air since 2007, so there is an entire backlog of wonderful episodes that you can listen to. They used to do, in their early days, Ghost Hunters and Up and Coming in the Paranormal, because that was what was going on at the time. Now they do a lot of celebrities. Most recently, they've had some people on from The X-Files. So if anybody wants to check that out, I think some of the listeners, particularly Michelle Barkley, might like to check that out if she hasn't already. That's where you can go to find it. So,
very good. Anything else, Mike, that you wanted to mention in passing?
We have been watching, I did forget, we have been watching the latest season of American Horror Story.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know whether that or Walking Dead is Pam's preferred show, but it's when we have a whole bunch of stuff to watch, those will be the two that we have to clear off the DVR right away. And I don't know, it's not scary is my real complaint about it, and it seems to be sort of like Seven, the TV series.
But not scary.
But not necessarily. There's a lot of stuff that's creepy in it, like Lady Gaga, because it's Lady Gaga. But it's, not like they're doing things like there's a segment where, the only way to say it is somebody is anally raped with what looks like a large drill bit in a scene that is very reminiscent of the lust scene, right, where you see these large dildo with the blade on it in Seven.
Yeah.
And boy, I hope we're only little kids listening to this one. But
I was going to say, boy, this episode just got real.
hey, American Horror Story, anybody can turn on this TV and you get it as long as you have cable or dish.
Yeah, so you have this guy committing a serial killer is killing people by
doing
the
that.
Theme of by the Ten Commandments. So, you know, obviously that ties in with the Cell Seven Sins. So it's very, very blatantly obvious, ripoff, homage, whatever you want to call it. And there's some interesting bits to it. I just, as the past seasons of American Horror Story have rolled out, I've gotten less and less confident that they actually have a clue where they're going with it. So it's very atmospheric. It's very well shot. It's very well acted, but I'm still like, is there going to be a point to this? Because we've been burned the last couple of seasons.
All I know is that Jessica Lange rules.
She's not in it anymore.
And she's not in it. Yeah.
That's a damn shame.
Yeah. I'm not thrilled with this season. I watched the first hour because the premiere episode was an hour and a half and I was kind of done. I'm like, all right, this is all, it really felt to me like shock jock value. Like, how can we be as disgusting as we can possibly be for absolutely no story reason? And that was when I was done.
Yeah,
I don't need to waste my time on this anymore. Thanks.
It's put Lady Gaga in. And Lady Gaga basically plays a vampire residing in the hotel. So they've added that to the American Horror Story mythology. I will say they've definitely shaken up the roles of the actors, because a lot of the actors, since they reuse them season to season, would still end up playing fairly similar parts every year. I don't know that that's – I think they've shaken that up a bit more dramatically. But I don't know. I'm willing to see where it goes. I don't find it bad enough. Yeah, I don't find it bad. I don't certainly find it bad enough to stop watching. But I'm not finding it necessarily as compelling as going back to the asylum or even back to the first season.
All right. Very well. All right. So anything further, Mike? Or?
No, that was a stretch just to get those two. Halloween's coming. I'll be giving out candy.
Very good. I hope we all will. What about you, Abe?
On my end, I managed to finally get to see The Martian.
Nice.
Okay. Nice. Don't talk too much about it, because that may be an episode coming up.
All right. I'll just say that I really enjoyed the film. I thought it was actually way better than both Gravity and Interstellar by a long shot.
Hmm.
It's hard for me to really say much about it without really spoiling anything, right, or just giving out anything before we even talk about it. But I'll definitely say that if you haven't seen it, to those listening, you will have to try to get out there as soon as you can, because I think its showings are kind of whittling down. But it is a major recommendation for me.
Okay.
Yes. Aside from continuing reading The Hollow, I've back in Rock and Chalk, I managed to pick up a novella by a fellow named Adam Caesar.
Oh, yeah.
Titled Tribesmen.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's one of his cannibal type thing.
Mm-hmm. It's not a very long one. In fact, you could probably finish it in a week or so. But because I've been juggling around with us, schoolwork and stuff, and my new job, it's been a little more of a journey. But it's definitely a good read so far.
All right. Anything else, Abe?
Nothing really on my end. I've been busy.
Okay. What about you, Chrissy?
My cousin and I watched 7 films this past weekend, which is a record for us in one day. We were kind of getting ready for this party I'm having Halloween night in between, so it probably actually would have been more, because we got up super early and started early. But we watched 2007's The Messengers with Dylan McDermott, and I highly recommend it. That was my second time watching it, and it has an interesting element to it. If you like J-horror at all, the Pang brothers, who are Korean filmmakers, did a lot of work on it. So it's got that J-horror sort of feel to it, even though it's set in broad daylight in North Dakota.
Actually, and to be honest, to interject, I think they're Thai.
Are they Thai? Okay.
Yeah, they're from Indochina, I believe. But go on.
Well, the thing that I watched on the DVD, they have a wonderful commentary and also an amazing, like, special feature that's – they call it a featurette, but it's about an hour. And I thought they had said they were Korean, but maybe they were Thai. I could be mistaken. But it was really well done. So I highly recommend it. It's a really good mystery. We watched a few that we have covered here on the show, like It Follows and The Babadook, because Marianne hadn't seen them. So we watched them a couple of times. But, oh my God, The Tomb. We finally got around to watching The Tomb, which is a Fangoria Fright Fest. It is terrible. That will easily go down as the worst film I have ever seen. What a hot
mess. There you go,
Mike.
There you go.
Oh, my God. I mean, I didn't even put it in my donate to savers pile when I was done. I threw it in the garbage. It was so bad. I was like, I'm not going to let anybody else be subjected to this. This is horrible. It was discombobulated. the editing was so choppy that you didn't
How
even
choppy
know what was,
was
happening.
It?
Oh my God. It was like, okay, wait, we had to actually stop the film and discuss what we thought might have happened. Because we're like, okay, what just happened there? It was clear that stuff had been left out. The rules of the universe that they had set up didn't make any sense. And they kept breaking them. There were characters who showed up only for the convenience of a plot for 5 seconds. And then you never saw them again. The characters assumed things that you knew they wouldn't know, and then the audience had to assume things. Like I said, we had to have discussions. We had to stop the movie and go, what did we just look at?
But let me just be clear. You were sober while you were watching this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were stone cold sober, yeah. We got up early and watched it, like, with our morning coffee. So we were alive because we had been looking forward to it. Huh?
Well, actually, for me, first thing in the morning would be a worse time to watch it. But
oh, no, that's the best time for me to watch a horror movie is get up, and because I'm really alert and ready. But, and then we watched, We Are Still Here also, and we watched a cheesy fave of mine from 1999 called Bats. Which
I
just.
Oh, I remember that one. I remember.
Oh my God, I love that movie.
With Blue Diamond Phillips, right?
Yes, it's so cheesy. It's so great. I just loved it. And, this week I'm working my way through Damnation Land 2010, which is the first year that Damnation Land, which is that small horror film festival in Maine. And so far, what I've seen has been pretty impressive. So I would definitely recommend that. You can still order the DVD online. My story, Our Lips Are Sealed, is now available in Sediments Literary Arts Journal's A Haunting Issue. And you can find that at sedimentslint.com. And the only reason I'm mentioning that is because I'm reading it, and I'm very impressed by the other writers in the magazine. There are some nice, fresh literary ghost stories in there. So if you're looking for something outside of the haunted house, outside of the box, things that are different, definitely pick up Sediments Literary Arts Journal's A Haunting Issue. And that's it. That's all I really did other than getting ready for this huge party.
So. And I saw from a Facebook post, you're closing in, you're on your 100th story published.
200.
Yes.
I thought it was 200th.
Yeah, no, it's only 100. It's only 100.
Good. Now she seems far less impressive, Phil. Thanks.
Yeah. No, I was doing a count because I am applying to a workshop. And so you have to list, whenever you apply to a workshop where you have to basically apply to get in and prove your worth to take this, because you're going to be studying with people who are really advanced and really awesome. This year it's Stuart Onan. It's Writers in Paradise at St. Petersburg, Florida. You have to kind of go through and say, okay, I've got this many stories published. And I was like, you know, I don't really know. So I had to go through and pull out my CV and go through and count what I had. And I was thrilled to discover that I was only 12 away from publishing 100. I was like, wow, I'm doing okay.
88, so, 88, I have wonderful works of fiction. But
yeah, not necessarily. They're not all wonderful, but whatever. It was just really cool to find that out. But I was like, okay, that's my 2016 goal, is to like hit that. But 12 stories in a year is a lot to ask. Because I write a story, sure, but then it's a lot of critique. It's a lot of post-work. It's a lot of making certain it's perfect, or as perfect as it can be before it goes anywhere. And I'm just not the type that I do sadly see. Sometimes they're like, I just wrote this story this morning and I'm sending it out. And I just want to go, oh my God, no. You know, sometimes these things take time to develop and you have to make sure they hit the right points. And yet that's probably why it doesn't take me as long to get them placed in a publication, because I do spend that much time. I take a long time to write things, but usually if I send it out, it almost always gets picked up. So, and, so anyway, so yes. So you can congratulate me next year if I make it to 100, but I don't know if I will. So we'll have to see.
Very good. Very good. So congratulations anyway for 88. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
The Pang brothers actually are Cantonese Hong Kong. However, they moved to Thailand and do all their work in Thailand, similar to like Gareth Edwards does Indonesian films, even though he's English. And one of the brothers is actually married to a Chinese Malaysian woman. And their films are produced through Thailand companies.
Actually, I was recently listening to the Drag Me to Hell episode, and I just about lost my mind at you guys bugging Phil for insisting that they be called Romanies because my grandmother was a gypsy. And she called herself a gypsy. So I was listening in the car laughing my ass off. I'm like, I wish I could call in right now and go, dude, it's okay to call us gypsies.
Well, what it was is it's okay. One of those terms that has been somewhat fallen out of favor is always what I meant. And now
it's only fallen out of favor because of people like you.
Also, for me, what I've seen, Mike, I did see that film, The Final Girls. I know you recommended it. Other folks recommended it, but it's been getting mixed reviews for a number of reasons. I actually enjoyed it a lot. It was a fun horror comedy with a lot of warm elements. The main complaint by folks that have seen it that don't like that it's parodying 1980s slasher horror films, and yet it's a PG-13 rating, and they're upset that it's not an R, because if they were going to parody it, if they were going to parody it to the point of how those type of films would be parodied, they would have the gore and the boobs and all that other stuff that you would see. So that's why it's probably getting mixed reviews, but I thought it was a good film, and I thought it could have been a film that could have played at theaters. I think it would have done pretty decent at theaters. I mean, it doesn't have any major stars. I mean, it has a couple of names, like, I forget her name, the woman from Watchmen that played the woman in Watchmen.
Right.
I forget her. And then, of course, and then the girl, Verminger, Vera Farmiga's
Veronica
sister.
Verminga, yeah.
Yeah, her little sister. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, I don't think there's any names that people would beat the door down to. The guy in the flashback, or from the movie, the actor, the character in the film that's a guy, I think is in on some show, but I don't know what show it is off the top of my head.
Okay.
So yeah, I don't think there's any names that would do it. I don't know that this would be it feels like more of a niche film, so I don't have an issue with it not going to theaters. But yeah, I don't know that this is a film that, and I'm not that I have a thing against gore or boobs, but I don't know how it would have been improved. Literally and truly improved by putting in those more exploitation elements.
You know what, Mike? I would agree with you because it was still a good film. But what I think the problem is like you said, it's a niche film for a niche audience. So it would be people who would want to, that are fans of those type of films. And so when they saw it, so me and you, we looked at it and said, oh yeah, this is just a really good film. But people who are fans of, you know, the slashes of the 80s where they have the cheese and the exploitation elements, I think that was the problem, because the people who would want to see this film, besides folks like me and you, would be mostly the niche audience that would say, why didn't they have all that stuff in it?
Right. I mean, there's a running joke with a character where they have to go to extreme lengths to keep her from taking her clothes off. that's working a gag in there. So other than maybe having a payoff where you finally see her boobs, I guess, but.
Just to chime in, Phil, some people who watch American Horror Story actually might recognize Tysa Farmiga. She was in season 3.
Right.
She was in season 1, too. She was the daughter in season 1.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yep. So she's some genre fans might recognize her from that show.
Yep, that's exactly right. So, yeah, that was a pretty good film. Not necessarily a top 20 for this year, but a good film nonetheless. And then I saw some other stuff I can't even remember, but the ones that I do remember is I saw The Mosquito, which is a 1995 film. It just came out on Blu-ray.
You've been posting a lot of stuff recently.
Yeah. But
I had to laugh when you said I'm watching Mosquito, and I was like, oh God, that was almost the worst movie I've ever seen.
But not
as bad as The Tomb, but pretty bad.
Well, it definitely has, some cheese to it with the acting and some of the one-liners, but the special effects were fantastic. And the film actually, if they played it straight, instead of having some of the characters saying stupid things. I think the film could have been like really good. I mean, that's a film that could easily be remade and actually work, I think. But I actually enjoyed it, Chrissy. But I could see how some folks would roll their eyes. Let's see what else I saw. I saw The Outing, which is another film from that era, actually 1988, I think. And it's about a genie in the lamp type of thing. And a bunch of kids are locked in a museum that get all murdered. So it's like a slasher with a genie instead. And that was pretty good. If you like horror films from the past, Mosquito and The Outing. I also saw a 1975, but I think it was released in the States in 78, Mexican horror film called Alucarda. It's released by Mondo Macabro, one of the good DVD Blu-ray companies that released these old films. And I was shocked how good it was. It was really scary, I thought. Good atmosphere. And the last 20 minutes was like crazy, insane. And high recommend for that film. It's actually was filmed in English. It's not subtitled. So that was interesting because I was expecting a subtitled film.
I don't think they like English anymore. I think they want Anglo-American.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But you know what? That's wrong. I'm sticking with English.
Okay.
Yeah.
As long as you're willing to offend somebody.
Well, to be honest, if you say anything other than English, then I think you're offending what it is, which is English.
But see, every time I hear comments like this, I think of that one fantastic line in the musical 1776, where it's a scene in which they're cutting up the Declaration of Independence. And they're saying, oh, we can't say this, strike that word. We can't say this, strike that word. And finally, John Adams stands up and says, it's a revolution, goddammit. We're going to have to offend somebody.
Indeed. But I haven't been the politically correct one tonight. I've just been spouting trivia about the Pang brothers. But either way, yeah, those are the films that I remember. I know I've seen, like you said, Eric, there's been a few others that I've probably posted that I've seen on Facebook, but I just can't remember offhand what they were. But I would recommend Mosquitoes if you like 1950s type giant monster movies, but done in 1995. So it's like an homage to those type of films. And The Outing if you like 80s horror. And Final Girls, as we discussed, but the big recommend would be the 1970 film Alucarda, Mexican horror film. You can get it on Mondo Macabro DVD right now. So that's it for me. I have
one more thing I need to talk about before we move on.
Of course, sir.
I actually have a moral obligation to fulfill. There is a podcast called The Last Horror Cast out there. For those of you who used to listen to Horror Etc. when they were weekly, it's sometimes Doug, who, as Horror Etc. became more and more infrequent, decided to pair up with his friend Scott and co-host a horror movie podcast. They have 9 episodes so far. They do it in a kind of interesting way, which is that they will choose a theme, and then each one of them will choose a movie. So there will be 2 movies per episode on a common theme that they will watch and discuss. I listened to their 2 episodes on While You Were Sleeping, where they talked about Sleep Tight and The Nightmare. And they also did a found footage Bigfoot episode where they talked about Willow Creek and Exists. And I actually sent them a voicemail. And I told them about how we tried to plug their podcast on our show, but botched it royally because none of us could remember the name of the podcast at the time. So they gave us a short plug on episode 9 of The Last Horror Cast and then told me I'm morally obligated to plug their show the next time we record. So I fulfilled my obligation and I can give a hearty recommendation to The Last Horror Cast.
And to be honest, we would gladly promote them at any point anyway. So it's not even an obligation. We would do it because they're good guys. Definitely good guys. And to name a few others, My Bloody Podcast by Jason Lloyd is a good one to check out. That's another one I would plug without any issues. Mike, you're going to say something?
Yeah, I'm curious to listen to I guess their latest episode, which was about underrated sequels. Given that sometimes Doug is apparently anti-aliens.
Right.
Which I actually like a lot of his opinions. However, that's just one I will never, ever.
That wasn't one of the movies they discussed, though. They discussed The Bride of Chucky and Ginger Snaps 2.
See, I don't know that Bride of Chucky is underrated. Seed of Chucky is, I think, bad, so you can make an argument that for it being underrated. But I kind of remembered Bride of Chucky being well regarded.
I that was while I was in college, so I am unaware of how it was received.
I do have a couple of things people posted on Facebook, our Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group. Shauna Jordan mentioned a film called The Perfect Host. Not 100% horror.
That's a good movie.
But definitely creepy, nice watch, and it's on Netflix. And you would recommend it as well, Eric, then?
Yeah, that's David I can't
Niles.
Get his name right. Yes, Niles from Frasier. David Hyde Pierce is the lead in that movie.
Oh, yes. Now I know that film. Yeah, I've seen the trailer. It looks really good. I have not seen it, though. But it is a good film, you say.
Yes.
Very good. Then Alan McPherson mentioned that about the trick-or-treat episode that we did. He said, great show, everybody. And he goes, Chrissy, the rule violation that you mentioned in the Brian Cox segment, he wasn't wearing a costume.
Yeah, I did acknowledge that in the Facebook post because I didn't. That,
wait a minute.
That could have
wait, he was dressed up as John Carpenter.
Don't know. All right. So he also, Alan McPherson, wrote something else. He wrote, because Chrissy mentioned how the trick-or-treating may have occurred. It started back in the 1880s or so in New York. But this is what Alan said. He says, just because it came up, he goes, there's a podcast called Food Nonfiction. And they did an episode on Halloween candy horror. And you can go to www.foodnonfiction.com. And I assume that you can probably find that on iTunes and Stitcher as well. But there's an episode that talks all about Halloween candy and where the tradition, I guess, started, at least in the U.S. of A. And let me see if I can figure out what episode that is on.
I'd like to listen to that very much. I'm so glad he brought that up. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I can't find an episode number, but just go to foodnonfiction.com.
I'll find it.
Yeah. Or you could just go to Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, find the new episode of Dark Discussions Trick or Treat. And he actually puts a link directly to that episode of foodnonfiction.com.
Yeah, I was following that thread, so maybe he just posted it recently and I didn't see it, but I will definitely put that on my list and check it out because I'm very interested in how all this kind of stuff gets developed. And
okay, well, that leads us, therefore, it has to open the door to certainly one of the more controversial elements of Halloween. Are we candy corn, pro or con?
Oh, I am so pro candy corn.
Yeah,
candy
pro.
Corn.
Yeah, pro.
I'm pro.
Yeah, as long as I don't have too much of it, I enjoy it when I do have it.
As long as there's no snake in it.
Yeah.
Well, the original candy corn was made with real honey, so that's why it was very rich. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, and I might be, because things change so quickly and, you know, we don't always sit around and say, hey, who's only got the original candy corn mixture out there just for kicks? I think Brock's is one of the few left that actually uses real honey.
Interesting.
But don't quote me on that, because a lot of it now has become corn syrup and they flavor it to taste like honey.
That's right.
But the original candy corn was made with real honey. And that's why you could only eat like a few pieces, because it was so rich. It was just like when I was a kid in the 70s, my mom used to buy the organic candy corn, you know, back before organic was like cool and all these people did it and they didn't really know what they were doing.
I just want to be clear. Organic is still not cool. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, it's still not cool to me either. But my mom was really into it, and she used to go to this store in downtown New Milford called Bobbitt's. And they had, like, at Halloween time, they'd have this bin of candy corn. Because it was like a feed store almost. You'd take, you know, it was before you had everything packaged, even if it was organic. So you'd take these big scoops and you just throw the stuff in a bag. And she used to get this candy corn, and it was made with real honey. Oh, my God. I mean, you could only eat, like, two or three pieces. It was that rich. And I think Brock's still has real honey in there, but in all honesty, I haven't checked in a while. I checked, like, 5 years ago, and they still did, but I haven't checked since. But anyway, okay. I digress. So there you go. All right. There's all my right. candy corn story.
All right, candy apple corn or caramel apple?
That's good, too.
Caramel.
Whatever.
Yeah, caramel, yeah. And what's the other one, Mike?
Or candy, caramel apple or candy apple?
Chocolate. Yeah,
they're both good. Also, on the Facebook group, Rodney Terrell has been posting pretty much daily 50 films before Halloween that he's been
rewatching.
I don't
know if he's going to make it.
that's right, because today is the
29th. He'll double up.
He will have to double up because he has four more to go and there's only 2 days left. And so for some example, and he does a little review of each of them as he's seen. Some of the films are very high profile, some aren't. 46 and was Evil Dead 2. 44 was the Evil Dead the original. So that's a couple examples. 45 was Phantasm. So there you got three classics right there. And then he's done various other films as well, including Knock Knock and things of that nature. Well, what's that, Eric?
I was just going to say, I give Rodney a lot of credit because he never sugarcoats anything as far as his opinion on movie goes. And one of the movies he covered was An American Werewolf in London, which he, on a horror Facebook group, came out and said he didn't think is all that good. So I give him credit for putting that out there because that's sure that'd be the most popular opinion.
Yeah, I haven't read that review, so I'm curious to see why he didn't like it. I could certainly see people.
Well, it's not that he disliked it. He just did, everybody's like, oh my God, it's the best movie. And he was like, it's good. You know?
But yeah. I can also see if you're somebody who missed the window of when that came out.
Well, that's what happened, Mike. Me and Chrissy, actually, I believe you did as well, Chrissy, wrote that we missed the window, so we don't have the nostalgia. So we're pretty much right on the same page as Rodney. That it's just
I was kind of like, it had been so hyped, and then finally I saw it.
Yeah, I was in my 20s
like
when I saw it.
5 years ago or something.
Yeah, same
and I was
with
like,
me, 5 years ago.
Okay, this is okay. Like, I was like, I guess this is great, but it didn't live up to all my high school friends who had seen it when it came out going, this is the greatest thing. And I was like, okay, you know, I just missed it for some reason. It wasn't like for any reason.
Part of it is the effects were groundbreaking at the time, but they were so groundbreaking that, like as often happens, you know, it's sort of the de facto standard and everybody has copied that and redone it. And I think the humor was really unexpected at the time.
Mike, you don't have to tell us it's a great film or not. I mean,
but like I can remember seeing it in '80 when I caught it on cable. I didn't see it in theaters not long after it came out, and I knew that the effects were supposed to be really good. There was a lot of stuff in it that I wasn't expecting, but I could certainly see how it doesn't necessarily hold up, especially after it's attained legendary status. Right? You know, it's
sure.
Right. I could see how it wouldn't live up to that.
Yeah, and to be honest, I mean, whether this is heresy or not, I saw The Howling and this one here, the London Werewolf one, and I always thought The Howling was better, and that's just me. I mean, I know I have a handful of people that will agree with me, so I don't think
I would be one of them, but I'm an unabashed Joe Dante fan.
It's been a long time since I saw The Howling.
Yeah, so you know, it really just comes down to taste, and like you said, Mike, the time period you got to see it and whatnot. The only last thing I wanted to bring up, there's been a couple of lists that I've posted on the Facebook group from various websites. AV Club has the best 25 horror films since 2000, and
a lot of lists I've seen have been like this century, and I'm like, why is this a thing? But okay, whatever.
Well, yeah. We're 15 years into it, and we don't, you know, it's like, well, do we want to do halfway
like
through
a mark of some
no,
sort?
No, but I don't think people want to do, well, it's sort of a mark, but not enough. So, like, people don't want to say, like, the best films of the last 5 years, because that's, for some reason, we were used to 10.
Right.
It seems silly to do one from 2005. So why not go all the way? So fuck it. Let's just go 2000 or 2001 on up.
I guess that's the logic.
I'm thinking that might be the logic of it.
Yeah.
Like I was actually thinking of myself before that. I was trying to come up with like the post-millennial, what horror icons have we really gotten? Because, you know, obviously we have the horror icons of the 30s and 40s, you know, the Universal monsters, and then of the, like the 80s and 70s. You know, and 70s.
And 90s then, with Ghostface.
Yeah, and the question is, yeah, Ghostface is sort of in that nebulous area because you have, I guess, we have Ghostface and Hannibal Lecter from the 90s are probably the only ones. Unless, when did Candyman come out? Was that in 1990?
That was in the 90s, yeah.
So you could throw Candyman in there. And then since then, well, you've had like, obviously Jigsaw.
Jigsaw.
It's because of Trick or Treat, I was thinking, because you have Sam. It was what got me thinking about this. And I have a Sam and a Captain Spaulding on my desk at school. The, what do you call the Funko figures?
Yep.
And some kids were picking them. Like, oh, they're so cute. It's like, yes, go watch A House of a Thousand Corpses. It's really cute. oh, that's right. You're the one who has a fear of clowns.
Now, I've come up with my own litmus test for those lists, which is that if The Descent is not on the list, then it's invalid.
Well, The Descent has been on most of the lists. It's just maybe not at the top. Most of them.
I found a couple that it's not on, though, and I'm just like, oh, okay, your opinion's invalid. Go away.
Well, and like we've all agreed, lists are very subjective. The AV Club, I've not been too happy with in the last year or two because I've read a lot of their reviews, and personally I find them to be kind of shallow. And not really, it depends on who's writing the reviews. So I kind of stopped reading them because I was finding I was getting annoyed when they were making blanket statements and not backing them up. And clearly they didn't do their homework. And so that annoyed me to the point where I'm like, I don't really need to go here. So they put out the list and I kind of scanned it and went, oh, okay. There's about six things on here that are just a hot mess. And I would never put them on my list, but it's the AV Club. I'm not surprised. So yeah, I would much rather go with people I trust. So that list I just kind of avoided. I mean, I was a little shocked to see Wolf Creek on there because I thought that was terrible. I was like, oh, you're putting Wolf Creek on here. Okay, whatever. So,
And that's what it comes down to. These lists are subjective. You know, some people think Wolf Creek is one of the best horror films of the past 15 years, and others, like you, Chris, you know, thought it was just a mess of torture porn. So it is what it is, but it is just curious always to see what pops up on some of these lists. And
yeah, but if you don't have The Descent on there, you're just wrong.
Yes, well, there you go again.
Well, and they did. I don't know where it was on the list, but it was on there.
Number seven.
Yeah, it was on there. I remember because I did look at the whole list and I did actually read what they had to say, just because they don't posted it.
And like I had an issue with so like I would have an issue with Wreck not being on the list, which normally I wouldn't complain about because it's a foreign film, but they had Audition on their list.
Yeah, they had Audition, they had Pulse, they had Orphanage, they had Martyrs, they had Inside.
Right, so
they
did
have
those
foreign films.
Right. Yeah, so they have foreign films. And I've mentioned before Ambush Bugs on Ain't It Cool News, and he's down to his top, I think, three. I'm trying to remember what was number three today. Oh, it was Late Phases, which, like, I'm liking the list as we go along more because I'm finding now more. You don't care what was number 30 on the list. You just say, oh, okay, he saw that movie. Like, I think We Are Still Here was, like, in the high 20s. And it's nice to see it on the list.
And yet that's a better film than Late Phases, right?
So well, and this is why I'm enjoying the list more, because while I can understand the list being on the top 30, I'm like, oh, my God, you know, how could you put that high? It's not that good of a movie. But that's kind of the fun part of the list, is the argument and the debate that the list generates.
Right.
Right. No, and nobody in their right mind says this is the definitive list of.
Well, Mike, when me, you, and Eric did our top 10 horror films of all time for us as people, you know, my favorite top 10, your favorite top 10, Eric's favorite top 10, I put mine in alphabetical order because, again, it's like you said, you know, 1 to 30.
Because you're a chicken and you didn't do it right.
Well, but you see my point, right? I mean,
I'm sorry, he's a poultry American.
That's right, a poultry. Actually, I would say a fowl American.
You're a fowl American. There you go.
Oh my God.
Yes. But yeah, I see your point, Mike, because yeah, it's like by labeling 1 to 30 and he puts a good film or possibly top 10 film of this year as a number 20 something and then puts a film that is all but forgotten as number 3.
But he also put Creep as number 4.
Okay, yeah.
That's so this is why you kind of go with that. Oh, right on. And then oh my god, how could you do that? Again, that's the I don't think I'd want to see a list. If I agreed with everything on the list,
yep.
I would forget the list really fast.
Yeah, sure, exactly. Sure.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's true. And you know, like Chrissy, I know you said you didn't like Wolf Creek, but I think me, Eric, and Abe and Mike all thought both the first and the second Wolf Creek were really good films. So,
like I said, it's all subjective, but it's just that I've read several of their reviews.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just not pleased with the work they're doing. It doesn't resonate with me for whatever reason. So,
yeah, which is
that's kind of a list I'm just not – I read it for fun, but I was like, whatever. Like, you know, I don't agree with
a website. Yeah, they're not a website I go to regularly, but I know I've gone to them and – a few times in the last few months, and I've just read stuff that I just thought was, you know, clearly this is being written by someone who is, you know, not well educated on the.
That's exactly what I felt.
The thing that they're talking about, and it doesn't necessarily make their views invalid, but their views are invalid. So,
yeah, like if you make a blanket statement that, which is what I kind of noticed, that you can't support. Like, they would state a fact, and then I'm the type of person that would actually go and look up that fact and see if it was actually true. And not necessarily looking on the internet. Like, I have tons of books in the basement. I'll go down and look it up, because I'm just that way, because I'm a freak like that. And I'll be like, okay, where are you getting this from? And it doesn't seem to be coming from anywhere. And that's what always bothers me. But then again, I'm kind of an academic in that way, so... You know, that's just me. I'm a freak like that.
Right. And there have been ones where I've seen where they just didn't do their homework, or they don't have the background information to know what the hell they're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. I'm okay with somebody making an opinion and saying, this is my opinion. However, I'm not necessarily well versed in this particular genre. Like when you guys were talking about Green Inferno. I don't know anything about the cannibal films. I really don't. So whatever you guys, and I have yet to listen to that episode yet, so don't condemn me, but I'm very excited to listen to it. But you guys have seen a lot of cannibal films. I have seen none. So I'm going to respect, other than Green Inferno, I haven't seen any. So I'm very excited to hear what you bring to that conversation because, so therefore, I'm not going to go on my blog and write this review of the Green Inferno with the thought that, oh, and I've seen all these cannibal films when I haven't seen a freaking one. Like, that's kind of not right. Like,
But see, that's the thing. I think if it's your blog, I would care less. It's when it's AV Club, which has some cachet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep,
it's okay. as being a professional website or
a money-making website, yeah.
Right. So like I read, you know, as a Yankees fan, I read a lot of Yankee blogs and there are some that are pseudo, if they're not officially endorsed, but they have a very high profile. They have hundreds or thousands or millions of readers. Right. They have access, you know, and you expect a different level of professionalism from them than, you know, Bob's blog, you know, that's got 50 readers and he's just spouting off based on his opinion, whatever it is.
Exactly.
You know, and you hold them to different standards and, same as you would, you know, somebody spouting off on politics, you know, on their blog versus, you know, what the Washington Post has written.
Which is, I would trust the guy spouting on his blog versus the real press because they're all corrupt.
Well, all right, let's move on.
Yes, let's move on.
Corrupts.
Moving on.
All right, so, so if folks want to go to Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, and there's a few links to a number of lists, controversial and not... some of them are interesting and whatnot. And some actually do have dissent on the list. Some may not, though. So, Eric, with that all stated, why don't you let everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
All right, tonight we're going to be discussing the new Guillermo del Toro movie currently in theaters, Crimson Peak.
Ghosts are real. That much I know. I've seen them all my life.
Would you be mine? Edith, this is my sister.
I don't think she's the right choice.
You have to trust me.
Thomas, your bride is frozen.
I'll run you a hot bath.
There are parts of the house that are unsafe.
What was that?
A house as old as this one becomes, in time, a living thing. Never go below this level. It starts holding on to things.
Has anyone died in this house? Specific deaths, violent deaths.
In your own best interest, proceed with caution, keeping them alive when they shouldn't be.
If you're here with me, give me a signal.
She knows everything.
Do we have to do this? Must we?
Yes. You have no idea what they do.
What do you want? I have to leave. You have nowhere else to go. This is your home now.
Crimson Peak is a 2015 film directed by Guillermo del Toro and co-written with Matthew Robbins. Everybody knows who Guillermo del Toro is by this point, so I don't think I have to go into his filmography. But Matthew Robbins is an interesting character. Matthew Robbins is a 69 or 70-year-old man, but has been in the industry for years, friends with George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. He's been a director and a screenwriter of some prominent films. He directed and wrote Dragon Slayer, one of the big sleepers of the 1980s, I think. I would think, Mike, you would agree with that. Wanting Sign.
One of the greatest dragons ever put to screen. Yeah.
So you would agree with me, too.
Yeah, it was a pretty good movie.
Yeah, Wanting Sign, Batteries Not Included. He did the screenplay for Mimic, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, the remake. He obviously did Crimson Peak, and a number of other non-genre related things. The film also stars some pretty impressive cast, though some folks aren't a big fan of her, but Mia Wasikowska is the lead actress. She's been in a number of films, including Stoker and the Alice in Wonderland film by Tim Burton. Then Jessica Chastain's in this. She's been in Mama and Take Shelter for genre films. Tom Hiddleston, probably one of the biggest geek actors right now, been in all the Marvel films. Lovers, what's that vampire film he was in? Lovers
Left Only Alive. Lovers Left Alive.
Yeah, exactly. Charlie Hunnam, another geek fan actor for most people in it that like genre. So the guy, he was in Sons of Anarchy and Pacific Rim.
And pulled the parachute and jumped out of 50 Shades of Grey before that could start filming.
Yeah, he chickened out or something. I don't know, who knows what happened. And then Jim Beaver, who's probably best known as Bobby in Supernatural. He was one of the stars
of
this film.
I did not recognize him in this movie.
Oh, you know how I knew
I saw his name in the credits. I was like, what?
I knew by his voice. His voice is so distinct.
I recognize him. I kind of wanted him to call. I wanted him to call Tom Hiddleston an idiot.
An idiot, yeah.
In my mind, his character is the ancestor of Bobby. That's how I think of it.
Indeed, Fernando Velasquez is the composer, and he's done a couple of interesting films, including M. Night Shyamalan's produced film Devil, and
bought the score today. The score for Crimson Peak is gorgeous.
It is good. He did also The Orphanage as well. And then the cinematographer I wanted to mention as well, Dan Losten. He's a Danish citizen, and he's done a number of really important films as well. He's done Brotherhood of the Wolf, which is a really interesting French film about a quasi-werewolf. Stars Monica Bellucci and I forget the guy's first name, but Cassell, which actually was the film that
Vincent,
Monica, yeah, Vincent Cassell. That's the film actually they met and fell in love and became husband and wife after that film. I have that on disc. It's a pretty good film. Darkness.
Yeah, I actually liked that one too.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Darkness Falls. He did Mimic. He did Silent Hill. No matter what you think of that film, the cinematography of that film was fantastic. So, in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, another one that got really good rave reviews for cinematography, even though the film wasn't that good. So that's pretty much the background of the film. Universal Pictures release, produced by Legendary Pictures. So let's go around the table, discuss how we heard about this film and their experience at the theater seeing it. Well, why don't we start with you, Abe?
For me, I first heard about this film through the numerous trailers that are being shown quite frequently. Looking at the trailers, it almost came off like a straight-up horror film, although when I went to see it, it's more of a gothic romance with some elements of horror in it. It's a good-looking film, and one thing I can definitely say about Del Toro is that he has a really good sense of style and presentation. You know, Hellboy, I really thought Pan's Labyrinth is another one that comes to mind. Like, he has these really cool designs, whether it's the sets or costumes and stuff. I have to also agree with Christy about the score. That was a beautiful score throughout the film. And I thought the actors did pretty well what they were given to work with. That being said, I was kind of underwhelmed by the whole narrative. I thought it was not exactly very new, in my opinion. I kind of called things before they occurred. And I felt some of the decisions some of the characters made were just kind of left me scratching my head. And I thought, that's pretty stupid. But overall, it was still an enjoyable film. I don't think I would consider it one of Del Toro's best. I could probably pick several of his flicks that are way better. But it was an enjoyable watch overall.
All right, very good. Chrissy, what about you?
I really loved it. When I first saw the trailers, I wasn't sure that I was going to go see it. But again, like Abe, I had seen trailer after trailer after trailer. I thought that the CGI looked cheesy. I was kind of like, this looks like a shocker film. I don't, you know, in terms of just, we're going to have a scare every 5 seconds from the way it was marketed. Then I found out after that it was from Guillermo del Toro. And then I was like, oh, okay. So then you guys said, we're going to do an episode. And I'm like, okay, I'm actually going to go see this. I saw it in IMAX. I thought it was beautifully shot. I thought the score was beautiful. It was moody. It was atmospheric. But, of course, it wasn't going to have any surprises because it is true gothic romance. And true gothic romance has specific conventions. I mean, even in Jane Eyre, you get some creepy stuff. You get some creepy stuff in Pride and Prejudice. You get some creepy stuff in Wuthering Heights. Everybody talks about Wuthering Heights. I think that was Emily Bronte, actually. And there's all kinds of creepy stuff in that. So I think he did honor to gothic romance because I am normally bored by that. I'm the girl who didn't finish reading Wuthering Heights because it was so boring. I went home and said, Dad, this is so boring. And he goes, honey, get my Cliff Notes in the basement. Don't worry about it. He's like, so I think that Del Toro really honored the conventions. I really enjoyed it. At no point during the movie did I look at my watch and go, oh my God, how much more time left do we have to go? Because sometimes I do that. I really do that. I do it frequently. So I know that if I don't do it in the theater, I'm totally sucked into the world. So I enjoyed it very much and I would give it a recommend just because I know we're not supposed to do this till the end, but I enjoyed it. But I think you have to manage your expectations. It's a gothic romance. And that's what it is. It's not a horror film. And I think that's probably why it hasn't been doing well, because they tried to market it like a horror film. And I think that's sort of sad because if they had marketed it as a gothic romance, they would have hit a whole different level of people, and that might have brought in a different fandom that would have brought their revenue up. So I think they actually hurt themselves by not marketing it the right way. So,
all right, very good. We'll discuss the marketing as part of our review when we get into that. Mike, what about yourself?
I knew about it because I like Del Toro, and I pay attention to what he's doing. And, you know, I just remember from when Pacific Rim came out that this was, you know, what was his next project going to be? And he tried getting In the Mouth of Madness made, and that fell through, and it ended up going with Crimson Peak. And I thought it was an interesting title, but I had no idea what it was going to be about. And when I realized it was a ghost story, and I deliberately avoided the trailers as much as I could. This was not something that our theater showed the trailer repeatedly for. So I saw the trailer like twice, probably. And I ignored the commercials when they were on. So a lot of this was fresh to me. I do get the CGI and the trailers looked spotty. It makes more sense, I think, in the film. But yeah, I think it's a throwback film. It is. I would still think that a gothic romance, I think it still has the horror elements. If you go back to what a horror story was, you know, before the slashers, before, you know, you got the extreme horror, you know, kicking in the 70s and 80s, it's a traditional horror film. This is the closest thing I can think of to a modern Hammer horror movie.
Well, Universal for that matter.
Or maybe even a Universal horror film. But even so, it's not as concerned with scaring you as, say, Robert Wise's The Haunting was, which was a haunted house flick. This is, and they stated right in the beginning of the film, in one of the most obvious, this is a metaphor headlines, is that this isn't a ghost story, it's a story with ghosts in it. You know, it's...
Yeah, it's, you know, that was line of dialogue.
Yeah, it was, and it works, but it's also a kind of eye-rollingly on the nose. But I did really enjoy this, and I don't know how well I'll like it on rewatch, because this is something where seeing it on the big screen, it is so lavish, so well designed. You could lose yourself in the costumes and the architecture or the art design and the music and just how, you know, how beautiful the film is. The performances I thought were fine. I really liked Tom Hiddleston's character because he was kind of nuanced, and I'll say that. We know Phil's going to dislike at least one part of the film.
Yeah,
but
I didn't like that.
Yeah, but you know, and I think maybe, you know, they could have maybe gotten to Crimson Peak a little sooner. I think as Del Toro films go, as much as I like it, I think it's a weaker effort. I think that the audience I saw it with, and I caught this with Pam on Friday night, the opening weekend. I think it was Friday night, maybe Saturday night. And so we saw it with a larger crowd. We usually catch matinees. So to me, the theater seemed crowded. So I was kind of surprised when you found out that basically it bombed at the box office relative to expectations. But the audience, I seemed like it, and like I remember there's a scene where Tom Hiddleston picks up who's the lead actress in this, Jessica Chastain?
The sister character? No, it's
the other one.
Wazikowski.
So he picks her up and carries her across the threshold into their new home, into the castle or whatever it is. And the girl sitting behind me, you just saw, like, I could hear her just lose her breath. Just like, ah, you know, just sort of. So the girls around me seem to be into it,
okay,
into this whole romance thing. So I do think with Christie, it might have been poorly marketed. I think it still fits in horror, but it's in the soft horror category, and gothic romance is part of the horror subgenre. Not my favorite Del Toro film, but again, I like almost all of his films. The only one I don't have a fondness for is the original Hellboy. I wouldn't consider that too much of a black mark. I'd certainly say it's worth catching if you can catch it, especially in the big screen.
Right, well, I do have to say, as the only female right now, this movie made me very excited in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I'll go next. Yeah, I heard about this movie in January when you guys, Mike and Eric and Abe, brought it up as part of the episode 169 of films to look forward to in 2015 that were genre. And the Crimson Peak was one of the films you guys mentioned. That's how I heard about it. I didn't even know it was coming out or cared because I'm not really a big fan of Del Toro. I love The Strain and I love the two Hellboy films. But everything else that he's done, I've been meh basically on. So, no excitement there because of the director. But then I saw the trailer and actually I was horrified because I thought it looked terrible. I did not like the trailers at all. However, certain people, like Jason Lloyd, said it was pretty good, Eric. So I said, oh, I guess I'll go check it out. And plus, it's Del Toro.
Oh, Jason said it was good.
Yeah. So it was an important director in genre anyway, so, you know, we should probably see it. And it was getting, interesting enough, 60% reviews, which is just, you know, above average, but nothing great. So I went in, I saw it. To be honest, I think I'm a little different than Mike. I liked the first half and didn't like it as much when they got to Crimson Peak. It appears that, Mike, you thought the other way around, that it was better during the Crimson Peak part.
I kind of was more interested in the first half, but I understood people who said that because the real story happens at Crimson Peak. So some people said that it took too long, too much prologue, not a lot of you know, the important stuff.
I see what you mean.
So I can understand that complaint.
Okay. So I'm pretty much right where Abe is, exactly where Abe is. So everything Abe said is pretty much exactly what I think as well. I didn't really like the film that much, but it was a good film, and I enjoyed it generally. There was no real – some scares, but nothing spectacular. I pretty much predicted everything. I know Chrissy said there's beats for gothic romances. Whether that's true or not, I pretty much knew who the bad folks were, what was going to happen, who was going to die, and on and on and on. I disliked a couple of scenes, not besides the dog scene where a dog does get killed, which was horrifying and terrible, which makes me, you know, at least take a star off my review. But there was a scene where there's a ghost in the hallway, and our lead character runs to her husband and says, "I just saw a woman in the hallway." And I'm like, what the fuck? It was a rotting corpse that was crawling on the floor. And so the reactions weren't necessarily that good in certain points. And then also, the film pretty much reminded me more. I mean, we're talking gothic romance, but it reminded me more of a poor man's film like The Changeling, or a film like a poor man's version of Sixth Sense or Stir Echoes, where there's a ghost that's trying to tell our lead character a story. She's scared of the ghost, but in reality, the ghost isn't evil. The real evil is something else, and the ghost is just basically trying to tell them to find out what that is. And so I didn't think there was anything original. Again, I don't think that's bad. Again, if this was a film that was made in 1975, and as Mike said, a Hammer horror film, I would probably say, yeah, this is a great film. I would love to have it on my collection with all my other Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing films and whatnot. But since it is not, therefore, all I can say is that I enjoyed it, but I don't think I'll have to ever revisit it again. Eric?
Y'all didn't leave me much to say. this movie is made with superior skill. It looks fantastic. It sounds fantastic. The acting is good. I agree with the points that Christy was making about the marketing campaign. I think it did a disservice to the movie, trying to make it look scary when it's really not scary. I also agree that there's nothing original here. This movie doesn't do anything that hasn't been done before. It just does it really well. So it is a great piece of filmmaking, not an original piece of storytelling. But I still enjoyed the experience of watching the movie.
All right, so very good. So that's pretty much our at least preliminary thoughts of the film. And though mixed, I think everybody would say it's a probably.
I mean, I recommend it. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Worth a watch for certain. But it appears that it may not be one of the best horror film, quote unquote. Well, let me rephrase it. One of the best genre films of the year. But I think some people here may think it is, and some people may not. But nothing that would be, oh, it's a horrible getaway. So let's at least give a synopsis. Eric, what you got for a synopsis? What's this film about?
Oh, let's see. What does IMDb say? In the aftermath of a family tragedy, an aspiring author is torn between her love for her childhood friend and the temptation of a mysterious outsider. Trying to escape the ghosts of her past, she is swept away to a house that breathes, bleeds, and remembers. That's a weird synopsis. I don't know if I'd call that entirely accurate, but whatever.
Yeah. I think I'm very, very inaccurate would be me.
It's not accurate at all because it's not really what it's about.
No.
It's about her struggling with her past is what it's really about.
That's true. But as a synopsis of the film, what not including what it symbolizes and the struggles and all that, basically I would say it's basically a wealthy woman of the bourgeois in 1900 USA, Buffalo, New York, and her father are presented with an opportunity for a mining tool by an Englishman who wants to use it to basically mine around his home in England, but obviously the tool could be used anywhere. And the father decides whether or not he is going to back the man. And when he finds out that the man has been turned down in three other areas in the world, Munich, Glasgow, and London, he's saying, well, now you're coming here to Buffalo, New York. I don't know. And what happens is that the stranger and his sister are basically in the city, you know, going around to the parties and whatnot. The man falls in love with our wealthy businessman's daughter, the wealthy businessman's
It's very clear that he's putting the moves on her just to try to get money.
At first.
That's how they set it up. And, you know, it's that he's trying to seduce her to get the investment from her father or from the family.
True. No, I would agree with that. Absolutely. It's too quick and he zero ends on her. And either way, she falls in love with him eventually. And when her father mysteriously dies in either an accident or a murder, we know it's a murder because we saw it. But it appears to be an accident because of the water was on the floor and people could
see. He accidentally fell and hit his head on the sink five times.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think what makes it really fishy right off the bat is the fact that he took one blow from the shatter of the sink.
Well, to be honest, Abe, I have to give Del Toro and I think the guy's name is Robbins, I forget, the screenwriter, credit because in real life, I mean, in movies, like, you have a whiskey bottle that's clubbed over someone's head and they don't die. In real life, if you're hit over the head with a whiskey bottle, you're dead. So I have to give them credit that the first blow to the sink, the guy not just has a concussion, but he actually cracks his skull and dies. So
I'm talking about the sink. The sink I'm talking about, not him.
Yeah, but those early sinks. Now we could argue that Phil mentioned that it was.
Sorry, I got to jump in here. Phil was trying to give his synopsis, and we've got.
All right, I'm sorry. Already. Finish your synopsis, Phil.
That's fine. That's fine because Abe and Chrissy, you guys can bring. We'll talk about that scene right after I finish the synopsis.
All right, go ahead.
So basically, what happens though? There was a ghost that comes to this girl telling her to beware of Crimson Peak, and we don't know what that means.
And it's been coming to her since her early childhood.
Right, and she believes it's her mother, maybe, the ghost. So anyway, they head after her father dies. She marries this English gentleman, and they head back to the UK and to a big mansion that's kind of deteriorating because it's similar to a lot of the wealthy families, whether in the States, France, anywhere, to be honest, that the upkeep and taxes for the property are just too much. And so you can't really afford to keep it up. So the building, even though it's still beautiful, it is somewhat dilapidated. And what happens is there's a big mystery. More ghosts appear at this mansion. She finally discovers that the mansion is nicknamed Crimson Peak. And so suddenly she's thinking, oh, there's something, this is bad because now I'm at the place the ghost of my mother told me not to be. And then there's a big mystery that happens about the man, meaning her husband, the man's sister, and the ghosts at the place, and a backstory that she didn't know about all these things. Without getting into spoilers. So any further things people wanted to bring up that I missed in this quick and utterly terrible synopsis?
I will say, having listened to plenty of podcasts, it seems to be the hardest part of reviewing the film is the synopsis.
Indeed.
Yeah. True. Well, because in all honesty, what Eric reads on IMDb, coming from a writer's standpoint, there's such a difference between a cell line or a cell couple of sentences and a synopsis. A synopsis is when you sell a novel or when you sell a film, you have to do what Phil just did. You have to say blow by blow what actually happens, because that is what agents, film directors, that's what they're looking at. The type of thing that Eric always reads on IMDb is more what's called, I forget what it's called, but it's more like a cell line. That's what you would give people to kind of intrigue them to going into the film saying, oh my God, that sounds really great. I want to go see it. But you're not supposed to reveal anything about the actual plot line.
Well, and that's why kind of the difference is to try and not give anything away before we start tearing apart the plot.
But unfortunately, in the last few years, what we've seen with both films, or what I've seen personally with both films and books, is they're giving me the synopsis on the back of the book. It's similar to what they do with trailers. They show you the whole freaking plot, and then I'm like, okay, well, I don't need to see this movie now.
But what Phil is doing
is actually a synopsis. He's giving you the blow by blow. That's what a synopsis is supposed to be. What Eric
they also give
is
you things like
teaser.
They also give you things like, you know, where if you've ever seen a story ever, they give it away even though they haven't given it away. For example, a series of mysterious murders plague London.
Yeah.
And Julie meets the man of her dreams who has a dark secret. Well, I think I know what the fucking dark secret is. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and a problem too is a lot of times the cell lines or sale lines are lame too, because they don't tell you anything. So we're in this period now in the past couple of years, as you said, Chrissy, where the synopsis tells too much and the sale line tells too little, and then we get this limbo. So what are you going to do?
And the trailer just fucking lies.
Yeah, and the trailer lies, exactly.
Well, it depends on the marketing.
So anybody want to add anything to that synopsis / sale line before we throw up the spoiler warning and discuss plot points and things of interest?
Well, you did leave out that there is a little dog, but...
Oh, yes. Well, that's part of the mystery of Crimson.
It's only a little dog. It's not worth mentioning.
Oh, good. So, all right, we'll throw up the spoiler alert. Boom. So now we can talk about anything otherwise. So, Abe and Chrissy, you guys were discussing the scene about the father and the sink. Well, Abe, you said the problem was that you didn't think the sink should have cracked when his head hit the sink?
Well, at least on that first... You know, for it to be an accident, like he apparently they bought the folks who investigated his death, or at least just concluded it was an accident. Just thought like, yeah, it took one blow for him to break that sink. I gotta say, maybe his face caving in, but for that sink to break after just one impact, I don't know. That's what bothered
me.
About
well,
that.
But you know what, Abe? Again, I'm not a big fan of this film, but I'll give credit with the screenwriter. Again, they had the Charlie Hunnam character who plays an eye doctor, come and look at the body, and he says that doesn't make sense. Because so they had that, even though you say it's an issue, at least they wrote a character in the movie to say, but it, that's, you really believe that it was just someone falling and it broke?
Well, but here's the thing. We, first of all, are not actually told what time in history this happens in.
Actually, I think it's supposed to be 1900 exactly.
Okay, but where does it say that in the film?
I don't know. I read it in a review, and I assumed it was something that the reviewer saw that I missed. But you could be
okay.
Right.
He
could be.
However,
just, he could just
her mother dies of black cholera. Black cholera hit Buffalo 3 times. I actually went and looked this up because I was really curious because I couldn't identify the timeline. So no, Eric, my head is not full of this crap. I actually went and looked this up. All right, just so you know.
I'm glad you don't know everything.
Yeah, no, really. I really went and looked this up because I was intrigued. Because for the whole first part of the movie, I was like, when the hell so is this actually taking place?
What were the three periods?
There were 3 periods in Buffalo when cholera hit. There was one in 1832.
Okay.
Which only claimed 120 victims.
Okay.
Which relative to the population of Buffalo at the time was very small.
Yep.
There was one in 1849, and then there was one in 1856.
Okay, so if that's the case, all three of them fall flat with the 1900 timeline. Because
right, exactly. It could have only happened in those 3 times, because here's the issue with cholera. Cholera, in case anybody doesn't know, but I'm sure Mike does, is spread through drinking water contaminated by feces, which carry the cholera bacterium.
Okay, so it's similar to spinal, whatever it's called, spinal meningitis, which is the same.
So what happens is it's from infected people or infected animals.
Yeah,
and back in those days, sewage seeped into the wells a lot. It was a big problem. The streets were full of mud. There were, you know, people shitting in holes. I mean, this is when we go back to the Black Plague even. I actually found a paper on the comparisons between cholera and the Black Plague, which I read, which was freaking fascinating. But that has no place on this podcast. It was very interesting. But the reality is this would put the movie, if we assume that it's 1832. Now, I don't know when Victorian England started, but that would be 1832. So that would put the start of this movie in 1842.
I think that's too early, given the...
I didn't know.
But actually, we got a good date, because the phonograph is invented already.
Oh, right, yeah.
And there is electricity in this, right? But then some of the streetlights have fire in them. So there wasn't actual real electricity yet.
Right. So it's probably someone then, you know, maybe they're not, the screenwriters decided not to, you know, they just randomly chose the disease then.
Well, and Del Toro actually wrote this, and he is famous because he loves magic realism. He's famous for blending fantasy and reality anyway. I mean, look at Penn's Labyrinth and, you know what I mean? There's bound to be some anachronisms and things because he just likes doing that. But particularly with her mother, you had mentioned the ghost and the ghost who shows up at the beginning. And she says there were no last words. There were no parting kisses until the night she came back. Del Toro, in the films that he actually wrote, does a lot with mother loss. He, in Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, the recent remake, he actually wrote that. The little girl is depressed because her mother has essentially forced her.
Actually, the screenwriter of this movie was the same one that did that film.
Okay, Del Toro worked closely with them because he actually has the writing credit, I think.
Matthew Robbins co-wrote this film.
Okay.
And the other film that you're mentioning, the one with the remake, what was it called again?
Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. Also co-written, yeah. So Robbins and Del Toro did the co-writing for both.
Did he do them for Mama, and did he do it for Pan's Labyrinth? Because there are significant mother deaths in all 4 films.
Okay, well, Mama, I don't think Del Toro did anything except produced. And Pan's Labyrinth, all right, Del Toro wrote the screenplay alone for that one.
For Pan's Labyrinth?
For Pan's Labyrinth, yes.
Okay.
And Mama, it was written by the director himself, the directors themselves. So it wasn't written by him. Yeah, it was by Andres Moschietti, an Argentine
who
film
probably
director.
Did the original short film.
He did, exactly.
But my point is that Del Toro does a lot with mother loss, little kids who've lost their parents. And so that moment in itself implies a lot. And I did want to talk about this because the mother, when the dead mother shows up, she's depicted almost malevolently in that first encounter, which happens within what, the first 8 minutes of the film?
Right.
And this is a 10-year-old who would be afraid of death. So any vision relating to death would be frightening because it's unknown. But even if this woman is delivering a warning, beware of Crimson Peak, it can be scary. The second thing we could chalk off to Edith is having a nightmare or even a premonition. She could, if you believe in that sort of thing, just have some sort of psychic ability, which allows her to see or sense the future. Third, and this is where it gets interesting, is that seeing ghosts of the recently deceased is not an uncommon step in the grief process. That hallucinations are often associated with people coming unhinged, but in reality, they're more commonly than we think associated when people are under duress. So was she hallucinating all this? I didn't mean to get this off track, but that really impressed me. I was like, oh my God, is she seeing her dead mother because she's just in such a state of shock and grief? Because later on in the film, that theme is repeated. So,
but then why wouldn't she see her dead father?
Well, no, she didn't have to because she blows out the candle. But we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
But Abe, getting back to the sink, sinks at that time were made of porcelain. They were much easier to break. Yeah. They were made of pure porcelain.
That makes more sense then.
Yeah. Go on about the movie.
Well, I was also say this is way before, or actually, you're dealing with the idea of forensic science. So the idea of doing crime scene recreation and an analysis of how did the basin break and how many times was it hit. If there was an easy explanation, there's a good chance the cops just went with the easy explanation.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
And I liked the doctor for that reason, because at that time too, depending on when we actually quote nail the time frame, there was a lot of that early sort of science going on, wasn't there, Mike, when people were doing that thing with the head shape? What was that called?
Phrenology.
And all that kind of crap. But there was a lot of sort of pseudoscience going on, which kind of gave birth to earlier forms of real science that we know today, if you can call it real science, because we're all just kind of fumbling around in the dark.
Right. And you had, what's his name, Conan Doyle, trying to get psychics to be used in court of law and
Edgar Allan Poe talking about the premature burial, and that was the first time they really learned about, oh God, what was that disorder? Which we know now is an actual disorder, not narcolepsy, it's catalepsy, where people look like they're dead, but they're not. They actually wake up. We know now that that is a real thing, and that's where the whole premature burial story came from. And all of this would have been going around at that time. Mesmerism too. Mesmerism was a big thing at the time this movie was set. So there was a lot of mystery to that. Photography, right? Because the guy shows her the ghost photographer, her early boyfriend that left her shows her the ghost photography. So this was all going on at that time. So it wasn't like today where we can say, Abe, okay, a sink wouldn't break. You're absolutely right. A sink probably wouldn't break today. But back then, probably not. It was all porcelain. It was just glass. It was just glass exposed to water every day. So it probably would have a much higher shatter ratio.
So obviously we got a time period piece. We do have Del Toro who throws in a like fantastical elements or makes, like you said, that realism, fantastical realism or whatnot. And then, of course, we can even go into certain nitpicks, too. Like, even though, Abe, you did have a really good point, you could argue that's a nitpick, right? Because, I mean, in a cowboy film, someone gets clubbed over the head with a whiskey and they don't die. And if I started saying, that's stupid, you could say, well, it's a movie, dude. Start nitpicking. So there's a lot of things we could pick and choose. But What about the plot itself, the beats, basically? Eric, did you know that Hiddleston may have had an alternative motive than just wanting to marry her? And again,
oh yes, true. Yeah, that's obvious.
Okay, yeah,
and, it's clear he's up to something, although you don't find out what for a while. And even after the father figures out what it is, they still don't. I didn't guess it at that point. You find out what it is later on.
You have the detective, Detective Holly. I can't remember the actor's name, but he played one of the scientists in Pacific Rim. He comes in. He's hired by the father to investigate Loki, and he comes in with the envelope, right? And the whatever it is, the dark secret.
Yep.
And the father confronts Loki with it, and he basically quickly backs down, goes, "Okay, I'm gone. I'm out of here. I'm leaving your daughter alone. I'm heading back to England with my tail tucked between my legs." And then the father is killed. So you know whatever he had was bad. And I was wondering, what would the evidence be? I was actually curious if it might have ended up being that he was gay, because that certainly would have been a big thing in 1900. That could have destroyed his family. But, it ends up not being that. So, so that's sort of the mystery, is that we are on the outside of, as the audience, is that he's got a secret, but we don't know what the secret is.
And just to do a non sequitur for a second, Wikipedia says the film starts in 1887, when she's a little girl, and then 14 years later, when she meets the Hiddleston character in 1901. So okay. that's supposed to be the time frame.
That's good. I'm glad that we actually can pinpoint it.
Yeah.
So that must have been an isolated case of cholera, but whatever.
Or he did.
It's a movie.
Pay attention. Yeah. Yeah.
So I did find it interesting how much I enjoyed the first part of the movie, considering that they marketed it as a horror movie and nothing even remotely scary happens until 30 minutes in. even the ghost of the mom at the beginning is not particularly scary. But I really got into the story that they were telling with the dad and the daughter and Loki and all of that. And I was kind of surprised that when they finally do get to Crimson Peak, I was kind of like, aw. And I was like, oh, wait, this is what the movie's supposed to be about. But I was really enjoying that first part of the story before they got to Crimson Peak.
That's the thing, is that the first part of the story was a very good period piece costume drama film with only minor supernatural elements in it, and I was enjoying myself tremendously too, Eric, even though I was there as a genre fan and not as a drama fan. And again, I enjoyed that part a lot better than the second part of the film as well, and I'm not sure why.
It was done really well. Like, there's the one scene where I'm gonna go with Mike here and call him Loki for the whole damn thing, where Loki's socially obligated to dance with this one high society woman and chooses the Mia Wasikowska character instead, and everybody's just like, I thought that scene was awesome.
Oh, and there was a major audible gasp.
Right.
When he reaches for
her hand and never just like, he didn't.
Yeah.
Well, and I got it. You know what? However I come across on the podcast, I am a romantic at heart. And this is, I thought that was one of the sexiest scenes I've seen in a movie in a long time.
Oh, no. I agree. And what I loved about that is, in retrospect, they're dancing with the candle and it doesn't blow out. And that foreshadows what happens later, because it kind of foreshadows that his flame of love, which that's the transformation that his character actually goes through.
Gotcha.
Loki, he learns to love for real.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end he becomes a spirit to her, but he truly did love her with a passion. So you have that symbolism, but at the end of the dance, she blows it out with her actual breath.
Right.
It's a superstition. It's why we have tampers. Do you guys have candle tampers?
No.
I don't think so.
Okay, you're never supposed to blow out a candle with your breath.
Too late.
People do it on their birthdays all the time.
Exactly. There is a long-standing tradition in many cultures. I'm going back to, you know, my grandmother, the gypsy, Philip, the gypsy, Romani cultures, Romania, Bulgaria, even the Ukraine. Then you get into pagan witchcraft, modern day pagan witchcraft. You're not supposed to blow out a candle with your own breath. And the reason you're not supposed to do that is because it means that you have condemned someone to die.
Sweet.
And it doesn't,
get some candles.
It's a real superstition. It's ages. It's thousands of years old. When you blow out a candle, it doesn't mean that you're necessarily thinking, oh, I want this person to die. That's not it at all. So she goes ahead and blows out this candle after that death. And she's so enraptured and enamored with Loki at that moment. And then the next day we see her father is killed. And who was the one thing standing in her way between getting between them?
The father.
Dun,
dun, dun.
And I was like, oh, holy crap. That is so awesome. I need to mention that. So again, I think Del Toro did his homework because it was in all those subtle things. And it's not like something that's obscure. You can Google that any day and it'll tell you don't ever blow out a candle with your breath. And yet we do it all the time. It's right, just, I've never done it. I have a million because I was raised by a gypsy. So
you don't blow out candles on your birthday?
No, I don't. I actually use a tamper.
And a tamper.
Because I don't know who I'm going to be killing if I do.
And the tamper are those things that you just put over the
yes.
The candle, basically, and it pushes it out.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds to me, Chris, that you'd be killing the people who are standing in your way, which would be a good thing.
Yeah, maybe I need to reconsider that.
So that's an interesting thing. And I buy everything you said, Chrissy, though I'm sure most of us probably that would have went right over our heads because, you know, I didn't even know that superstition for that matter. But some folks probably do.
Yeah, I'm going to guess this is not an Italian superstition because I'm sure my grandmother would have brought it up at some point.
No, it's not. It's very much
sounds Eastern European.
Yeah, it's mostly Romania, Bulgaria, the Ukraine, a lot of Russian cultures. Yeah. Modern witches have adopted it. Like modern pagans have adopted it, but I don't know where that line is. I just know it definitely comes from those kind of snowy areas where my dad's mom came from. Because I was actually raised with that. We were not allowed to blow candles out on our birthday.
And where was your dad's mom originally from?
My dad's mom was originally from a little tiny city in Czechoslovakia, which is no longer, called Brno, B-R-N-O.
Yep.
And her ancestry before that is very blurred, but I'm pretty sure she had a lot of gypsy because she did a lot of tea leaves and a lot of all that kind of stuff. And, you know, she spoke a language that no longer exists. So, I mean, it's not out there today. So, it's just interesting because the second I saw her blow out that candle, I went, oh my God, I even called my sister and said, holy crap. It was like the whole movie. I knew how it was going to end just from that one moment.
But you know what? You know what?
And then my sister's like, "You're a freak."
You know what though? This reminds me of another film that does something like this. The Deer Hunter, where at the Russian wedding in Pittsburgh, they're supposed to drink from this cup. It without spilling a drop, because if you spill a drop, then someone will die. And we see in that film, they show, and that's not even a supernatural film. And in that film, we see a drop fall on the wedding gown of the bride. And sure enough, her boyfriend, becomes paralyzed and whatever during the war. But obviously in that film, it was quote unquote kind of heavy handed in a sense. But this film, you know, if you don't know this law that you just mentioned, then it would have been over my head completely. But it's the same principle, though.
Yeah, I thought it was just really interesting to see that he did that. But again, Del Toro is very, he's very well read. He's very into superstition. He's very into symbols. So also, I was going into a Del Toro film. So I was already aware to look for that stuff. You know, if I had been going into a film by
Michael Bay,
I don't know, some other dude, you know, Steven Spielberg, I probably wouldn't have even made that connection. You know what I mean? I would have been like, yeah, whatever. But with Del Toro, he does so much research and he just really appreciates all kinds of things. And he's so subtle with so much stuff, which is why even though he's delivered films to me that were disappointments, I always go back because he always gives me something.
Now, Mike, what about you?
Well, I like you said, the period piece. I like that setting, even though there's almost nothing supernatural in it. other than like a quick cameo by the ghost here or there. I do think it helps having, I think Bobby, whatever his name is, again, I'm blanking on it, Jim Beaver, I think is really good in it. And I think that's part of it. I think he's an interesting character. I love the little scene where he basically rips into him in front of the board. And there's a lot of very American and or classic American idealism sort of, and oh, some of the working man bullshit too with it. That, you know, give me your hands, Hooper.
Yeah, I, oh my god, right god, that's what I thought of too. I'm like, oh my god, yeah. Are we replaying Jaws?
But it's, you know, it's the whole thing I think is captivating, and all the characters are likable, and Loki, you know, is playing her. I don't remember the exact sequence, but we find out very early has a conversation with the sister about, you know, he takes her the ring and she talks about all she had to go through to get the ring and, you know, because that's the only thing of value they have for an engagement. And it's clear they're just playing them for the money. So you're really odd there, but it is just a really well told romance. But what I love is when you get to Crimson Peak, and there it starts falling more into more predictable plot threads. But I love the concept of Crimson Peak in that you have this, it's not a castle.
It's a mansion.
What is it?
It's a mansion.
So you have a mansion sitting on top of, on a mountainside or a hilltop, whatever you want to call it, of red clay. On a peak of red clay that can be used to make that can be used to make strong bricks, and that's the value of it. But the idea that number one, when it snows, the red seeps up from the ground and stains the snow red, which is where it gets the name Crimson Peak. So that's a great visual. That literally the center of the house is rotted away.
It's very fall of the House of Usher.
Yes, and so that's exactly what Pam said.
It's very remote too, which is kind of makes it unlivable in a sense too.
Right, and so you have this house that is this beautiful house, but it's literally rotting from the center out, with a hole in the roof. So you walk into the entrance hall, and you know you have rain or snow falling in the middle because they just don't have the money to keep it up. And the house is rotting away.
Well,
and,
actually, when you're done, I have a question about that. But go ahead.
But I just love the metaphor of it, the visual of it, the concept of, you know, with all this red clay, and that's why the ghosts, as we find out later, the quote unquote ghosts that we're seeing, are covered in the red clay, which is what adds to sort of the artificiality, I think, of the CGI.
Yeah.
Out of context, when you see it in the commercials and the trailers, not realizing that they're soaked in red clay, I think it looks more artificial within context of the film, and they probably had more time, obviously, to finish the effects. I think it works better. But it's again, the design of it and the design of the house, the design of the whole area, the design of the film is fantastic. But I love the design of the house and just the thought of and the symbolism of the house itself.
Now, a lot of folks loved that. A lot of the reviewers said the same thing as you, Mike. I'm not agreeing with this statement because of the type of film it is, but I just wanted to throw it out as a devil's advocate to see what you would think. Did you think that symbolism in that house and the way they presented it and with this family and whatever, was it heavy-handed?
Well, yeah, but so is Mrs. Havisham from Great Expectations.
Yep.
You know, it's, you know, so yeah, it's heavy handed, but when it worked so well, I don't care that it's heavy handed to me.
Yep. No, that's good.
Yeah, it was beautiful to look at. My question, Mike, was when she first gets there, it's supposed to be like in the fall, and there was stuff falling through the ceiling, which looks like leaves, because later on in the movie, we see there are clearly dead leaves. And yet this house is on a field in the middle of nowhere, and there's no trees. So where are these leaves coming from?
Ghost. I sure those were leaves. I thought they were like
that paint bugged me through the whole thing. I was like, "Where are these leaves? The snow I got."
Chrissy. What, Abe? What did you think it was, Abe?
Yeah,
I thought maybe it was like small pieces of the house, of the roof coming off slowly.
Oh, okay, I could buy that.
Yep. Yeah, like wallpaper, things like that, plaster, whatever.
How about ghost leaves?
Ghost leaves.
Devil leaves.
Or you caught a, you know, a fact, whatever type of error.
Well, but, you know, like I said, Del Toro loves to blend fantasy and reality in that way that doesn't quite mesh with things that make sense. So once I was done being bothered by that, I was kind of like, well, you know what? You're watching a Guillermo del Toro film. Like, there are going to be things in here that just don't make sense. Move on. It was just kind of interesting. I don't
enjoy a movie, Christy, because you just notice too much shit.
But she's enjoying it on levels.
I enjoy it. Oh my God. I already pre-ordered the movie.
but she's seeing the candle. She's enjoying it on levels that you can't understand, dude.
She's
enjoying it deeper. Yeah.
Now, hey, what about you? Why don't you throw something out?
One of the issues I had with the film was the siblings' plot, their plan. For the first part of it, I seemed to be okay with it, but when I found out how the sister was going about doing it, I thought it was a little overly complex, you know, considering what they were trying to do. Especially, and also due to the fact that the main character's way of dealing with it, she made some dumb decisions, like, what we find out later at some point is that the sister was poisoning each of the wives, Loki's wives, with poisonous tea, and would slowly kill them off doing that. Actually, she finds out and she tries to leave. She ends up in bed because I think passes out from the poison beforehand. And when she's in bed, the sister offers her tea again, but she refuses. But then when she offers the porridge, she eats it. And I'm thinking, like, you honestly don't think that wasn't poison as well?
Agreed. I totally agreed, Abe. What the hell?
I am totally with Abe on what he's saying here, because I was thinking about this whole scheme they had going on, and I'm like, is mining clay for bricks really that lucrative? I honestly don't know. Christy?
Well, Eric, I remember when I went to Thousand Islands, and we went on like the tour in Thousand Islands, and there's this huge home on one of the islands, mm-hmm. and they point out that the home is owned by a guy who makes twisty ties for bread bags. Mm-hmm. And you'd think, can making twisty ties for bread bags be that lucrative? Apparently, yes, you can. So,
okay.
No, but even because
all the money he scammed for financing his whatever the hell miracle mining machine he was working on, I thought that was a little bit weird too. He spent all those years and all that money trying to build that machine, when in that amount of time, if he just used the damn shovel, he could have sold something by now. But I did find the whole scheme a little elaborate, and although. I will point out that the sister poisoning the wives, crazy people don't use the best logic always, so.
Yeah, and to answer the question about the brick mining and how it could be that lucrative, back at the time, no matter what time, I think we decided it was what, early
1900s? 1901.
Yep. There were major building booms going on. You have to remember, this was before World War I. It was still considered the Golden Age. So there was a lot of inventing going on in terms of history. There were a lot of new ways of looking at things. Some of the greatest buildings of our time were drawn plans for. And when he shows up at her father's firm, there's a guy there's a couple of guys. I don't know if you caught it, but there's a couple of guys and they're looking at, oh God, is it the building on Wall Street, the stock exchange or something? It's like a full scale model of a famous building.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That these architects are discussing. So this was the time when, forgive me, I can't remember when Carnegie was around, but this was kind of around that time.
Yeah, I think he was around about then.
Were building these amazing buildings.
Wasn't it the Iron Building or the Iron?
Carnegie Steel.
But the building.
Oh, the Flatiron Building?
Yeah, the Flatiron Building. Wasn't that what it was?
It might have been. I wanted to look it up before the podcast, but I didn't get a chance.
I'd have to take a look.
Yeah, I'd have to take another look.
Again, these are just small things.
They're all small things. But it's just interesting to note that it would have made sense. Like, it didn't bother me that he was going around scamming people at this time because I was like, okay, this is perfect. Because that was when especially America was really looking to find new materials, find ways to do them faster and cheaper. It made total sense, which is why his scam made sense, because the father was like, oh, you tried this in Milan and Edinburgh and London, and nobody bought it. Well, those were older cultures. America was still a new enterprising culture at that time. The father even says it. We were built on sweat and whatever the hell he says, you know, and back then, London and Milan and all of these cultures in Europe, they'd already been around for thousands of years. So of course they wouldn't really be interested in anything that was newfangled and that kind of didn't work for them. But America was willing to take chances. And so that kind of thing totally rang true to me. And I thought that Del Toro did a good job sort of showing the industrial age. And yet she's early industrial. I'm not really clear on that. Somebody can go look it up. But yeah, at that time. But I do agree with Abe on what he said too, because that there were some things that were just a little bit too complicated and they didn't need to be. However, that was also why I enjoyed it, because I wasn't necessarily expecting it. And I do agree with, once they got to Crimson Peak, I was sort of bored. I was kind of like, okay, all the good stuff's over.
Jessica Chastain. I thought she was fantastic in this movie. And although she was a little over the top at the points, I thought that's exactly what was called for at those points. And there's only one moment where I thought it went a little too far. Which was when she reveals her relationship with her brother to Mia. And she's like, you're probably not even his sister. And she's like, oh, but yes, I am. It's like, whoa, okay, you're a little too happy about that. but other than that, I thought she really had a transfixing performance in this movie from the very first time we see her in the room playing the piano.
Now, if I could be the quote unquote devil's advocate again, and again, I'm not agreeing with this, but I could see people saying it. Do you think she played it way over the top and corny? I did not. I think it fit right for the type of role in the quote unquote gothic romance. That's how some actors would play it in films back in, you know, 30, 40, 60 years ago.
No, I thought it was perfect, except for the one moment I just mentioned.
Yep.
And she was a nutcase.
Yes, that's true. She was a crazy, crazy woman.
Crazy bitch.
Yes. Thank you, Abe.
Just in case you missed it. Yeah.
Mike, so any further things you wanted to bring up about her besides that she's a crazy bitch?
Well, no, but I mean, I know we're going to, if we haven't spoiled the hell out of it already, I was expecting to find out, well, she was the real wife. I didn't know that they were going to go the full, you know, the full incest thing, but they did, and credit to them for that.
Oh, me too. I thought at one point, I'm like, oh, she's the real wife, and then she's like, yeah, I'm his sister. When, I was like, oh, ew.
When they found the document, when the dad showed him the document, I thought that might have been their marriage license. That's where I was going with that.
Yeah, that's so, you know, full credit to them for going the whole Rocky Horror route. But, yeah, we have to give him a dark secret, so if he wasn't gay, that's even better.
I'm not gay. I bang my sister.
and even at the end, he's still, and I like the fact that at the end, even after he's like, Oh, but I love you, and I really am. My love for you is still true. But I still want to keep banging my
sister.
Yeah. I still want to keep banging my sister. So I like the fact, and this is something I said when we did the original Phantom of the Opera, is I like the fact that he's still a villain. He just has a villain with a redeeming quality, but he's not redeemed.
Well, let me ask you this, Mike. Did he really want to go back to the sister, or was she basically blackmailing him and putting him in that predicament?
Well, both.
Yeah.
I think maybe he found it easier to continue their physical relationship than trying to break it off.
Well, and what it's really going back to is the Madonna whore complex, right? I mean, he's screwing his sister, and she's easy to screw, and she's right there, and it's convenient. Plus, she exhibits control over him. He is aware that she's crazy because she got sent away and he got sent to what, a boarding school or something? Yes. So, but she went to some other school. So he's already aware.
Wasn't that heavily implied that she killed their parents?
Yes, yeah. Toward the end. So the thing is that he's sort of stuck between Scylla and Charybdis. And then I thought Edith was actually the woman that he really truly did love.
Right.
Because at the end, he burns. He kills her. They kill each other, the sister and the brother, right? No. Right.
No.
She kills him. Oh my God.
Edith kills the sister.
Edith kills the sister at the very end.
Yeah.
But yet what was interesting there is that they both see his ghost at the end.
Right.
Which could be attributed to traumatic death because they both loved him and they were both having a grief hallucination together.
No.
Which there is documentation for that, actually, in the real world. Or, you know, or it was a supernatural thing. And that would have been his character arc, that he actually went through character conflict crisis change and that he broke free of his controlling sister.
Well, and I noticed something interesting when we do see his ghost at the end of the movie there. Apparently this is, and I don't know whether this is something that comes from, I don't know, Spanish ghost storytelling or whether this is just strictly a Guillermo del Toro thing. But you notice that the wound he had on his face when he was a ghost, there was like this, it was like he was underwater and you saw the blood still coming out of it.
Yeah.
That was very similar to his portrayal of a ghost in Devil's Backbone.
Right. Yes. Now that was something that, but in Devil's Backbone, it was a child who drowned, so it made sense.
Right.
But so I forgot about that
consistency. That's something he tends to just associate with the depiction of ghosts, and I thought that was interesting.
Well, he's made comments in the past that a lot of his films, in his mind, take place in the same world, so I think there's a certain consistency he's going for.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, for example, like the Tooth Fairies in Hellboy 2
mm-hmm.
are very similar in design to some of the fairies you see in Pan's Labyrinth.
Okay.
Right, and the ghost crawling across the floor, the first ghost we see in Crimson Peak, where that was very Mama-esque.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I definitely agree there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's part of it could just also be like Tim Burton. He's you know, got a certain artistic style that he sticks with. But, yeah, I like the effect. I think the effect, for me, worked better in Devil's Backbone, which I think is a much, much better film. But it is a new design, and for 90% of the American audience, it's going to be a complete, you know, something they haven't seen before.
Right.
Well, I did think, okay, well, there's a thing with the moths.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And this is something that, having an Italian grandmother that supposedly, we weren't allowed to kill the moths because they were the spirits of the dead coming back to say, hey, how you doing?
Okay. I would agree. Yep.
And, well, I don't agree. I think they're moths. But I think so. That's an obvious piece of symbolism that I'm fairly certain Del Toro knows all about. And it's because, and like Chrissy said, it's because it's Del Toro. And it's not that I like him and I respect his work.
It's heavy-handed too, right?
It is heavy-handed, but it's also that I know he is into all this shit. So I think this is obviously very deliberate because it's him. And he know, like, so it could have been coincidence for somebody else, but for him, I'm pretty sure, yeah, he knew, he knows what he's sprinkling in there.
Well,
so,
well, like, and to be honest, they were basically throwaway scenes if, without that symbolism.
Without the symbolism, they would have been, but moths represent, they can represent the shadow, they can represent otherworldly, they can represent secrets and concealment. It depends on what culture you're in. They can also represent intuition. However, there is no moth that I know of that actually eats butterflies. Just in case you all were wondering.
Yeah, not that I'm aware of, but it's...
Right, exactly. So that was kind of maybe a symbolistic statement or a veiled metaphorical statement about that moths, our secrets, can keep us from transforming into beautiful butterflies. That's kind of the way I took it, because butterflies are typically a symbol of transformation, and we do see that in the Loki character arc. But in some religions, like Christianity, butterflies can represent the soul. So it depends on what religion you're looking at or what context you're coming to it from, if that makes any sense, on what it actually means. So I think what he had here was a whole metaphor that he was trying to paint with moths and butterflies to sort of work toward the single effect to make the statement. However, the butterflies he used in the film, near as I can tell, are a variety of Eastern swallowtail called, oh crap, yellow something or other. Yellow, I'll have to shut up a minute and go look at my notes. I wrote it down. But they're very specific. And swallowtails are interesting too, because they have, and I only know this because I spent the whole summer working at the butterfly exhibit at the Maritime Aquarium, so I had to answer people's questions all day long. Swallowtails, that little dip that they have on their wings is used as a rosary mechanism. So they can wave it to confuse bats, because bats are their number one predator. So they can actually throw off bats' sonar by doing that. Right. And what do bats represent? Secrets of the night. So it's just, it's working on so many levels.
Well, let me interject here. With you know, the moths with the candle and blowing it out versus using a tamper and Del Toro doing this. I mean, it's just a movie. Why does he have to add these? I'm just being devil's advocate here, but.
Some would say you're being an ass.
But honestly, you could argue that it's pretentious. And again, and it's like, why does he need it? What's the point? I mean, we get the story alone is enough. Whether we ever talked about the moths or the candles, I mean, how many people are really talking about it except maybe, you know, people like us?
I know four, but, yeah, five.
So. Yeah, but otherwise, I don't see it as something.
Well, because it's like I said on another show or something. I think it was one of you guys' things. It works into the collective unconscious. We all have those things speak to us on a level, even if we don't look into them and interpret them, even if we don't see them. We all watch movies or we all read books, and there's something that kind of hits us in the core, and maybe we don't slow down and take time to look at that, or maybe we don't take time to analyze it, and that's fine.
But let me interject. What happens if it's so heavy-handed as this? I mean, for example, we've seen films like Horsehead and whatnot that has it too, but obviously he's trying to make – the mystery is the entire dream.
This film was not heavy-handed. I didn't feel this film was heavy-handed. I sat there in the theater with like six other people, and they were all having an awesome time. And I could tell that the experience they were having was completely different from the experience I was having, because I was just grabbing onto all these things again because I knew I was watching Del Toro, and I'm like, he's going to put crap in here. I need to find out what it is. But I'm just that kind of viewer. You know, there are people that just go to this and they're just going to enjoy it. And that's great. That's awesome. I wish I could be like that, actually,
That's not what I mean, though. What I mean is the things that we're mentioning here, the moths and the candle, aren't essential to the plot, at least in my opinion.
No, they're totally not. You can totally enjoy this movie without discussing that. Absolutely. You totally could.
So it's just he just does it because does he think it's cool, or is it?
Or does he even know he's doing it? I mean, Phil, you're a writer like I am.
Well, you know what? Candle one.
Do you put things in your stories?
Well, but I have to disagree on this one because the moth one was so inconsequential to anything.
Oh, see, no, I didn't. I saw that moth and immediately went, "Oh, holy crap! Here we go."
Yeah, but,
but that's just me.
But again, though, it wasn't essential to the plot in the sense that he put it in because he wanted to be. Yeah, what's up, Eric?
I think you're just a Del Toro hater.
No, all right, well, let me ask you, Eric, and I'm trying to be honest here. To have the moths in it and symbolize in the rebirth or the death or whatever you want to talk about.
It's fine. Symbolism is allowed.
Okay. All right. I was just curious. That's all.
You can have a meal without all your herbs and spices and still gives you the nutrition, but you like having the herbs and spices. You know, you want the. You know, it adds something to it, enriches it, even if it's, you know, and you have some things that are really obvious, like when they come out, right, like at the beginning, you know, you want heavy-handed this is a story
of lovely with lady.
Ghosts in it.
Oh.
Yeah, this is a story with ghosts in it. It's not a ghost story. That was heavy-handed because it's like just coming right out and telling you that.
Okay.
You know, the last episode of... Sons of Anarchy, you know, was, you know, really heavy-handed with its metaphor, you know, where even, you know, the most addle-brained person picks it up.
Sure.
But, like, the moths, most people aren't necessarily going to pick up on a conscious level, but there's certainly all the stuff that Christie said moths stand for. It all makes sense, whether you knew that symbolically they stand for it or that they stand for that in certain, in cultures and myths and things like that. Whether or not people are aware of it, it's because there are certain characteristics we associate with moths because they're creatures of the night, that it all makes sense. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why nobody looks at a moth and sees it as a symbol of happiness and joy.
Well, Mike, and that's the thing. It's like when that scene, the first scene came in about when she's looking at the pupae or whatever it's called, and Chastain comes over and starts talking about it, I instantly knew, okay, the only reason this is in here is because this is a symbol for something. And at that point, I was saying, okay, it's something about the change in life or the growth in life or the metamorphosis in life. I mean, we've seen it in Silence of the Lambs, you know, I mean, all these things.
Right, I didn't necessarily think that her doing that scene with her explaining the black moths and crap, I did not think that scene needed to be there. I think you could have cut that out, and it would have been fine.
Yeah, it would have been
absolutely.
Yeah. That's
I agree.
And there are a lot of times when I listen to commentaries, especially by writers, and they'll talk about scenes that they cut, and they'll say they cut the scene because they were over-explaining. And I think that's a natural tendency, is to assume that your audience isn't going to get what you're telling them, maybe for good reason.
Okay.
And then they watch it, and they go, you know what, they get it. And so, yeah, that might be something that could have been dropped. These are things that add flavor. And I also think that when you're writing something, well... you need to put something down. Well, what are you going to put down? Well, you figure out a reason why they're eating whatever food they're eating. And
sometimes.
Yeah, you know, right. Yeah, just to give some subtext. And just because it may mean something to you, even if nobody ever gets it.
Sure.
You know,
it depends, though. There's certain screenplays, parts of screenplays, like they would just write a scene, people having dinner, and then the director or the actor can come in and say, oh, could I have it, make it tacos? And the writer didn't care. He just wrote, you know, like for example, Dan O'Bannon in Alien. He says he named the characters ambiguously gender because it didn't matter what their gender was.
But even that then is important, right?
Well, yeah, that's fair. That's fair. But again, though, certain things are written a certain way, and then there's certain things that are put in specifically, and obviously the moth scene was put in specifically. It wasn't like it wasn't in the screenplay that said two women hanging around a tree. It said two women talking about the metamorphosis of a thing. And again,
right. However, at San Diego Comic-Con, they did have a Crimson Peak promotional exhibit.
Okay.
And they had a lot of the props and things there. Yep. And I actually found online photos of the exhibit, and over half of the dioramas that they had, the little diorama things. They all had insects in them.
Okay.
And then apparently, and butterflies and moths specifically, different kinds of butterflies. And at the time, they hadn't decided which final butterflies were going to actually make the cut of the film. So that tells me that he was doing a lot of thought about this whole butterfly thing.
Sure.
However, I do agree with you. I don't think the scene about them discussing the butterflies needed to be there. I was like,
now,
you could have just had them flying around but I would have picked it up anyway.
Right, you know? But I also think Del Toro, in a non-pretentious way, is an artist, and certain artists sometimes come back to certain things that intrigue them thematically. Yeah, Tim Burton, you know, black and white stripes and spirals, right? These pop up in every movie he does. There's something about that appeals to him.
Sure.
There's something about, I'm going out on a limb and saying from the Del Toro films I've seen, he's got a bug fetish.
Yeah. And he's got a mother fetish too.
He's got a mother fetish. Just like, Tim Burton has a daddy fetish. He has a mommy fetish. So they're coming back to it again and again. And Del Toro is somebody who's involved in every stage of production. And like, as a writer, if you don't give a shit what they're eating in the meal, you write down, they sat down, they ate their meal, and you don't mention it. In a movie, they sat down and ate the meal. Somebody is being paid to put a meal on the table. And that person, maybe it could be because they take their job seriously, or it could just be because they need to find something to keep themselves from being bored. Will think about, you know, they'll say, Del Toro, what do you want there? And if he says, I don't care what you want.
Or a sponsor pays for, I want the Burger King there.
Yeah, okay, which would have been weird in 1901, but... right, but if they say I don't care what it is, there's a good chance that the set decorator or whoever it is that puts the food out, they'll pick it for a reason. They'll pick that particular meal for a reason. Because, well, why not? I can pick it because it takes no more effort to pick something for no reason than it does to find a reason to do it. When you name a character, sometimes you name a character because the name has symbolic significance.
Yep.
And sometimes you name a character because you named it after your nephew or something. You just name it after somebody you know. But there's a reason for the name, because it's actually easier to have a name with a reason behind it than it is to just come up with a name that has nothing connected to you whatsoever.
No, that's fair.
There's a theory out there that artists or writers or filmmakers or whatever, they will commonly work with the same theme or the same symbol or whatever over and over and over again until they have personally resolved whatever their issue with that is. And the fact that Del Toro has done several things about mother loss in movies he's been involved with tells me that whatever that issue is that is deep inside his soul, he hasn't resolved yet.
Well,
and that because he'll keep doing it until finally he lays it to rest.
I would like to interject. Simon Rumley, director of Red, White, and Blue and The Living and the Dead, both films, the mother dies of cancer is dying of cancer in both films. And his mother died of cancer in real life. So, right.
So he may actually be working through that issue. Right. And the way to... Okay, we used to talk about this in Goddard all the time. We used to laugh about it, actually. We used to say Goddard was where I went to get my MFA, in case anybody doesn't know, any of the listeners. But it was like we used to laugh all the time because we would have people there writing blatant memoirs about, look at how my father did this and look at how my mother did this to me and that and this and that and the other thing. And they were writing all of this nonfiction that was just so... honestly boring and self-indulgent. And then there was a whole crowd of us that were like, okay, yeah, well, we can't handle the tragedies that happened to us, but we need to put this into a fictional setting or a fictional context, because there might be people out there that are struggling with this same issue that through fiction, they can relate to this. They can feel bad and maybe they can heal through that. Now, I don't mean that I sit down and write every story with my dead mother in it or some crap that I'm hoping to reach somebody, because that's not what I'm doing. I'm writing to heal myself. Right. And yet I have gotten letters from people saying, oh my God, that story helped me just make me see that I need to work on this, or I miss my mom, or whatever it is. So that's the great thing about art of any kind, is that it's meant to sort of heal us, if you want to be all like crunchy about it. But yeah,
well, also, but you think know, about, which, and I was just thinking about this before, oddly enough, before you brought it up, but is think about, like little kids. And one of the ways that often they can be, there's warning signs like about abuse is in their drawings and their paintings, you know.
Oh, and, Jesus. I got a great story for you. I'll tell you this one in a second about me.
All right. Yeah. Go on. And then Phil, I want to hear your story. Go.
Right. But it's, you're right, but it's the kid isn't saying, I'm going to draw dark images with a scary man because I'm being touched in a bad place when I go home at night. The kid's working through things when they draw stuff that's on some level, whether they realize, and they're communicating it to others. And sometimes the artists, obviously, as you're an adult and you're hopefully an artist of quality and being paid by Hollywood or whatever, you may or may not be aware of how much of that those themes are coming through, but it's the same thing as you keep coming back to certain ideas because it's something you are working through, and it's yeah. It's really not any different necessarily than that. And you know, when you know, it's the you know, the Rorschach test, right? You know, what do you see in the ink blot when you have a blank piece of paper? What do you put down on it? And that's could be what you're working through,
right? Yeah, when I was a kid, well, you know, watched the creature features on Saturdays, whatever, and the Universals, Frankenstein, Dracula, and all that, Godzilla, and so forth, and one weekend, I learned how to, 7 years old, 6 years old, whatever. I started drawing the monsters on a piece of paper, and I figured out how to draw Frankenstein and whatnot. So that week in school, I'm in school, and we have this paper where we have to draw pictures of whatever is there. So, you know, sister, dog, your pet, you know, whatever. So, you know, I draw my sister, I draw my dog, I draw whatever. And then there's a picture of my mother, it says. And by this point, I'm bored as hell. I go, this sucks. I'm drawing Frankenstein. He's awesome. So I draw Frankenstein where my mother's supposed to be. And so I pass it in. And then the next day,
my God.
I have the principal, the vice principal, the team sitting me down. Philip, are you okay? You know, and asking me about my mother as if she's a, you know, and I'm like, and then it never occurred to me until like, you know, 30 years later, I look back at it and I go, oh my God, they were thinking I was being abused.
Yeah.
And, right. And I was, yeah. And it had nothing to do with that. It had to do with that. I was bored at what I'm doing. Right. And I just learned how to make Frankenstein.
Exactly. And, you know, that's why Freud said sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
Cigar. Exactly.
Usually it's a giant black penis, but usually it's just a cigar.
Right.
You can always overread into it and you can always go through it too much. But there's often people who say that a lot of art comes out of some pain, even if it's, you know, wimpy pain. Yeah, I had a friend who had to go see a therapist because he had to write a short story. He wrote something about nuclear war, and they're like, "Oh, go see a therapist." It's like this is 1980, you know, or 1981. Everybody was obsessed with nuclear war because, you know,
it was
we were told every day we were going to die by nuclear fire.
Exactly. Yep.
And it's a cool topic
too. It's like a lot of my short stories still deal with mother loss and whatever. I'm still not over that yet. I don't know if I'll ever be over that, but I know that's my way of processing. And yet every time somebody writes me a letter, which isn't all the time, but I do get some, at least once a year, I get one from some random person I don't know who read some short story that I wrote that had a, you know, dead mother in it or whatever. And it'll be just the most amazing letter about or email about, thank you so much because this makes me feel like I'm connected to something and I'm not lost anymore and I need to start dealing with this thing I haven't processed yet. And so great. So if I keep writing these things and somebody else is benefiting from this, and eventually I'll stop writing about it because eventually I will work through my own issues. But that doesn't mean that I sit down and intentionally be like, oh, I'm going to write stuff about dead mothers. I don't do that. I don't stop and think about that. It just comes out. And I think that's what Del Toro does in a lot of his films. He's clearly dealing with issues that he can share with others. Like my sister was like, oh, I'm going to see Crimson Peak. And I literally said, that's great. Watch out for the opening 5 minutes where the dead mother shows up because it's not a good time. And you're not going to sleep. And I said, maybe nobody else thought it was scary, but I was scared as fuck. I was like, I was done, because that was something we went through. So I could relate to that. Whereas, and she could, I know she can relate to that, but other people might just be like, oh, it's a scary CGI thing, whatever, move on. You know? So I think that's the beauty of art, and that's the beauty of film, and that's the beauty of everything. It's not necessarily that we sit down and intentionally decide to do it. It's just sometimes it comes out. And that's why I think I'm a big Del Toro fan. Even though I have seen a lot of his stuff I don't like, to be honest with you, I don't like that all his ghosts end up being happy at the end. That really bugs me. They're all redeemed at the end. I'm like, why are the ghost, every single ghost story he does, all the ghosts are good at the end.
Right.
I'm like, okay, that's really annoying. It annoys me to this day. But to somebody else, that might really be redeeming. So, you know.
I've said this in the past. That's one of the things that sort of bothers me about a lot of ghost stories, is that, like the Changeling, they end up turning into a Scooby-Doo mystery.
Yeah, mystery.
And,
yeah.
And once you solve the mystery, the ghost is happily ever after. They're just a warning. And you really have to have it well done for me to maintain interest. And like Devil's Backbone, I think, is one that did that.
Yeah.
And like, so, yeah, here, the idea that the creepy ghost mom was really there just as a warning to say, my children are crazy incestual beings, and you probably shouldn't have married my dumbass son. Right, fine. You know, I didn't, it's like, that's not really the way I like my ghosts. I want my ghosts to be scary and dangerous, like in Poltergeist.
Yes.
And that's my personal preference. But I recognize that there's a big body of ghosts that, yeah, they're just here to be helpful spirit guides. That just
metaphors
happen to look scary as fuck sometimes. You know, it's just.
Well, and Del Toro also has a thing about bog bodies.
Yeah.
He's really obsessed with the whole idea of bog bodies, which is probably why his ghosts always look the way they do. They always look like they're skeletal and covered in muck. And he said this in several interviews, that he's very obsessed with bog bodies. And the thing is, I don't think he's made his consummate bog body movie yet. So until he does,
I hope he doesn't. Jesus.
Yeah, but maybe he does, because then maybe he'll get it out of his system.
It's gonna be a gothic romance between a fat Spanish guy and a ghostly bog body.
Mother.
Get busy in a swamp somewhere.
Yeah, but even all his
over on a bed of insects,
and you know, they all look like bog bodies. So I would like to point out also that I loved the scene when she goes into the publisher's office, because in the publishing industry at that time, what was going on was that you did have to deliver handwritten manuscripts, even though meetings weren't necessarily required. And the comments about the handwriting being too feminine, that was really true. There was a lot of chauvinism in the 19th century in the publishing industry. And
that's why George Eliot.
Yep, and many women at the time wrote under male pen names.
That's right.
The Bronte sisters, Jane Eyre, which I think Charlotte Bronte wrote, and Wuthering Heights, which Emily wrote, were written under male names. And Louisa May Alcott, I think, also had a male pen name.
Anybody here watch Warehouse 13 at all?
No.
Yeah.
I tried it once.
Wells is a character on that show, and it's a woman.
Oh, really? Okay, cool.
That's a little funny. But all in all, again, that was a weird thing in the film, too, because I see the point, what he was trying to do, you know, women's rights and whatnot and all that, and how it was back then. But we never really go back to it once we leave Buffalo. I mean, that whole storyline was...
Oh, no, I disagree, because the whole point was she had an amazing, quote, imagination. And that was what played her once she got to Crimson Peak. That was establishing, basically, the way I took that was not a statement on women's rights at all. I took that more as we needed to establish that she was a dreamer and a flake and didn't really have a job and, you know, and this is what she wanted, and that she had an imagination, which was later going to kind of sink her ass.
Now she's
going to marry this wealthy guy.
Let me rephrase, because you misunderstood what I meant. What I meant was, is that plot point was brought up as a big plot point of her at the beginning, of that she was writing a book and whatnot. And then it disappeared after 20 minutes, and it never came back except when she Chastain was throwing the book in the fireplace.
Well, I think it was for me that was functionally a mechanism to the character, to audience identification and understanding the character, is that you understand who she is and what her hopes and dreams are, but it also gives you some empathy for her to see that her rejected, and that it also works as a mechanism to help you embrace Tom Hiddleston, because he at least purports to like her writing.
Right. I second that. I definitely
so,
agree.
Right. So,
and there was that powerful moment where the father says, "You must thoroughly break her heart." And what does he do? He doesn't break up with her. He says, "Your book is a piece of shit."
Right.
Basically,
right.
That's what he says. And that's when she loses it.
So I think it had, I think its narrative function was done for the most part at that point.
Yep.
I think it's, but like, I don't think if she was a writer and we just came in and she was still writing a story and he saw it, it would have meant nearly as much as if we had seen her rejected for such a shallow and superficial reason. Or at least as we would see it today as a superficial reason. And then her taking the pains to type everything on a typewriter when typewriters were new and hard to use. To do this just to try to get a chance to do the end run around it, we can appreciate her efforts, and it tells us a lot about the character and her motivation and what matters to her, what's important to her. And so it becomes important to us, and that, again, opens the door for Loki to step through.
Fair point. Excellent, excellent point, Mike. All right, so any further things anybody wanted to say? And then I guess we can wrap up our opinions and so forth on the film.
I think we've thoroughly beaten this into the ground.
Indeed.
Indeed.
I buried it
into the red clay. Let's build a house.
Woo!
All right, so let's go around. Final thoughts. Chrissy, why don't you start?
Well, I thought this film was really good as long as you understand what it is. It's a classic gothic romance with supernatural elements, which is what basically a gothic romance really is. It has a weak heroine who is desperate to be rescued, even though she's strong and struggling to be independent. It has the undercurrent of deep secrets. It has the mother obsession thing, which was also a huge part of gothic romance. It has decaying houses, which represents the fear of lost wealth, which was a very big thing at that time when gothic romances were popular. So if you're into that and you love beautiful sets and atmosphere, then this is the movie for you. If you're looking for a terrifying ghost story, this is not it. So, you know, it's, I enjoyed it, but I also think a lot of that was my personal preference. So that's it. That's all I have to say.
Very good. Yeah, I'll go next. I actually, think it's probably I guess third or fourth favorite Del Toro film. Obviously, I liked it better than most of his other ghost stories because, again, it did have that Hammer feel. It didn't do anything original. It was pretty much predictable. But, again, if this was a film that I picked up on DVD or saw it as a monster or a creature feature film when I was a kid, I would have said, yeah, this is a good film. And 20 years later, oh, I got to get that DVD and add it to my collection like the rest. So I could see this film being a good one for nostalgia for folks that like it now. And then 20 years later go, oh, yeah, that was a great film. I loved it. All in all, unfortunately, the film was falsely advertised. I don't know whose fault that was. And it's definitely was curious how this film, a lot of the fans who like Pacific Rim and those type of films by Del Toro and The Strain and The Hellboy, how the folks who love Del Toro looked upon this film, they kind of, I think, are looking at it as like, oh, this isn't Mimic and Blade and The Strain. This is, I don't know what it is. So it's definitely not a film I would recommend for every fan of Del Toro. I would recommend it as pretty much what Chrissy said. If you're a fan of gothic stories like The Castle of Truro and Dracula and the Hammer films and things like that, then this is your film. So that's pretty much what I would say. Eric.
I think this is a visually stunning film with a fantastic score and a completely unoriginal story. If you're somebody who can enjoy a film for its atmosphere and its presentation and aren't looking to be scared necessarily, go ahead and check this out. If you want a scary ghost story, like Christy said, go somewhere else. This ain't it. I actually think Del Toro is pretty smart to drop that ham-fisted piece of dialogue into the movie just for critics to understand what he was doing. Is that this is not a ghost story; it's a story with ghosts in it.
Mike,
would be a great date film if it stayed in theaters long enough. But I guess if you're one of those stay home and Netflix people, that could work for a cozy night in. It's horror. It's got ghosts. It's got some moments. It's a throwback. And I definitely recommend watching it. And, with the right frame of mind. I don't know how much the marketing mishandled it because, before people actually see the film, how do they know it's been mismarketed?
So, I'll probably end up echoing what other people said, but in the end, it's going to be a take it or leave it kind of film. It's not going to snag everyone, but overall, it's a pretty good film, in my opinion. Its presentation, atmosphere, sets are fantastic. And as I said beforehand, in the beginning, that's one of Del Toro's strength, is his costuming, how he creates these worlds around you and just gives them such life. That's one of his real talents there. I felt that the actors did well. I think everyone actually did well. I didn't have any problem with any of the actors. It should be echoed as well, is that there is no real scares. It's not really a horror movie. It's got elements of horror, but that's not the real main focus. That's not what you'll be going to this movie to see. Don't listen to what the trailers are showing you, because that's just an example of a misleading trailer. It's teasing something that is not really what you're going to be getting. It's
BS.
It's BS. It's false advertising, pretty much. And if you go into it with that mindset, knowing what it is, I'm certain that you at least like it a lot better than those who went into the film thinking they were going to get straight up horror. I recommend it, whether it's be on the screen or DVD or DVR or whatever. I still think it's worth checking out.
All right, very good. All right, so very good. So that's Crimson Peak 2015 and Del Toro's latest film. And catch it now when it's in the theaters, but I'm sure by early next year it'll be on disc and VOD. So with all that stated, Eric, why don't you do this out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in to listen to us attempt to talk about Crimson Peak. Come back next week. We'll talk about something else.